You the builder of the good plane. You the builder of the big bombs. You that hide behind the walls. You that hide behind the desk. Just want you to know. I see through your mask. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little. Put a gun in my hand, and you hide from my eyes, and turn and run far when the fast bullets fly. Like a Judas of old, your lie you deceive. World war can be won. You want me to be.
We're not.
But I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain. Like I see through the waters that run down my brain. You fasten the triggers for the others to fire, and sit back and watch when the death count gets high. You hide in your mansion as the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and buried in the that's the worst fear that can never be heard. Fear to bring children into the world. Threatening my baby. Say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. But there's one thing I know. Though I'm younger than you, even Jesus would never. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it
by you forgiveness. Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll. The worst fear that can never be
heard. Want to play another one, Rama? No. That's apropos. Thank you, Rama. That's called Masters of War. And Odetta knows what's going on. I know she's on the other side, but she's always been right where we needed her to be. So she's right where she needs to be, everyone. Yeah, Rama wants to play something. This is called The Nature of Stargates, and it's Metatron through Tiburon. So let's hear this.
April 25th.
That's good. That's a good time.
Yeah.
All right, here we go.
Greetings, Masters. I am Metatron, Lord of Light. We greet you in a vector of unconditional love. We welcome each of you individually as you read these words. With the diminishing of the magnetic grid and the emergence of the 144 crystalline grid, Arizona and Arkansas are now the most potent crystalline portals in North America. Arizona will be extremely active in the harmonic portal Stargate energies of May 2014. The Aquarian resonance during the harmonic trigger aperture will combine the Grand Canyon energies with that of the Sedona Sonoran and Sangre de Cristo's vortexial regions. What then will occur for the embellished phase is a triangulated matrix of some 300 plus miles per side in oscillating harmonic reach. We emphatically tell you that the telluric energies that flow within this expanded Sedona vortexial region are absolutely laden with codes of the upshift and are essential to the Aquarian shift of the new Earth. And so we speak in this gathering on a most timely topic, the vortexial energies of Arizona and the powerful energies of the Stargate portal. We tell you that the energies of the Arizona vortexial portal complexes are extremely important for 2014 and beyond. These represent the receival point of new codes for the Americas in the crystalline shift. Now, we wish to share two important clarifications. First, our use of the term sacred site requires a brief caveat. To be clear, the Earth in all parts is sacred, but there are specific locations on the planet that carry far greater energy, far greater access to the higher realms. Humanity refers to these as sacred sites. Perhaps a more accurate defining term is power node, vectors of vortexial portals formed from a myriad of sources that are conscious teachers and extraordinary gateways. Second, there may be some of you that may feel the Sedona area is no longer as potent as it once was in centuries past because of the habitation of the human populace within the vortexial frequencies. We tell you emphatically that this is not the case. This is a misunderstanding of the nature of such localities. We tell you, in fact, the vortexial points of Arizona are graduating to an utterly astonishing renewed potency and even greater importance in the energies of the new Earth. So to further explain, the Earth is consciously multidimensional and can be more accurately termed as the Omni-Earth. Masters, the grand consciousness of the living Earth exists in a vastly different modality and sequence of time than does humanity. The Sedona Vortex has been in place for hundreds of millions of years, geologically speaking. A linear sequence of human habitation of less than two centuries has little impact on its integral, non-linear, multidimensional reality, even within chronological aspect. This is true for all power nodes, for indeed each sacred site, each power node and stargate, has a unique frequential signature and sentient consciousness, a succinct spirit of place that is above the duality realm of the third dimension. That is why one must be able to raise their vibration to unlock the key to such vectors. That is why what occurs in 3D duality cannot truly malaffect the true nature and higher resonance of power nodes. Nothing occurs on the Earth that is not under the conscious mastery of the divine living Earth. Although better understanding and wise stewardship is essential, humanity would not be in any area that is currently habited if it were not purposely granted for at least a period of time. There is indeed a reason for humanity having access to specific living cathedrals. Those areas on the Earth you term power points are apexes of infinity. These points are the primary dissemination mechanism of higher dimensional energies. The vortex portal templates that occur on the Earth are uniquely varied, yet have many benevolent commonalities. Within specific power nodes that humanity termed as sacred sites, the door to sacred knowledge is opened, and a catalytic energy exchange occurs. The pilgrim and focal seeker can become imprinted with the code keys of frequential wisdom, unique to each sacred site visited. In kind, each pilgrim imprints their highest reverence into the energy of place. One may receive coded light energy from the site and feed higher frequential energy back into it. A synergistic transposition ensues as each seeker begins to manifest the impeccability and higher dimensional perfection of every sacred site visited, each melding and building upon the other. You carry with you the energy of every power node you visit, and indeed each pilgrimage, each spiritual quest amplifies your energy coding. Power nodes can be defined in simplistic terms as areas that resonate at a higher vibration and are catalysts for spiritual experience. Such areas often radiate crystal electromagnetic fields of higher frequency. These locations can be naturally occurring or man-made. The latter are often temples or stone circles built over naturally occurring ley lines or energy points. Temples, cathedrals, and pyramids built to sacred geometry actually attract and amplify energies, especially when built over telluric hotspots that contain crystallized minerals such as quartz. Numerous sacred sites are aligned celestially at specific angles to cosmic points. The vortexial matrix of certain power nodes on the planet are what may be termed purification or crucible vectors. This is indeed a rare and yet perfect blend of energies for revealing what is hidden. It is the perfect storm. Not all vortexes are as such. Each will vary. Each will spin according to its purpose and design. In these locales, there is a purposed intensity that can be either a stepping stone or a hindrance. Sedona, the alchemy is there. Sedona is such a crucible vector. It provides a matrix of purification. Sedona is an energy that bubbles up all that does not serve you. Although it can be said that Sedona was truly never meant to be an area for inhabiting of habitude, that is because it is an energy that can be very intense. In ancient days, only those spiritually advanced were chosen to live within the potent frequencies, because these savants, these shamanic masters, understood how to optimally merge with and communicate harmoniously with such living energies without being overwhelmed by them. Sedona is capable of great spikes of energy. That is why some of the residents of Sedona may appear to be eccentric or imbalanced. The electromagnetic frequential in power sites can in itself create what we will term an energetic pressure differential with the human CEF, crystal electric field, or auric field. In the process and period of equalization, auric fissures can occur until such time as the balance is recreated. As such, there are times when it is prudent for the human to not overstay in power sites until their auric energy is better adjusted to the harmonic. Those who choose to live in such sites will in time either gain the equilibrium or experience imbalance. This is why the indigenous societies utilize the vortexial sites of the American West for a place of vision and introspection, but not for placing villages. Sedona projects a telluric energy prone to intense electrical spikes, not always conducive to emotional tranquility or agreement. That is why many who reside within the core center of this energy are susceptible to erratic and extreme emotional highs and lows and eccentric behavior. Yet it is and remains a perfect energy for visioning, for spiritual purification, and questing. And indeed, despite what some may feel, it has not lost that quality. Quite the contrary. It is, in truth, more potent in 2014 than at any time in its matrix, and this frequency will grow annually through 2038. The alchemy of the greater Sedona vortex is absolutely still there. Indeed, how could it be otherwise? Sedona is quite beautiful in its red rock environment. Indeed, many are captivated by its visual allure. It is an extremely high energy, and while some are capable of adjusting to its highly charged voltage, others find that living outside the electric vortex is far more tranquil. It is indeed an energy of inspirational amplification, but not sustainable for all. But be aware that the vortexial parameters of Sedona do vary. We will verify that the parameters are expanding, but there are cyclic phases in which a natural contraction will also occur. Depending on astrological and telluric measures, the circular diameter can be approximated from 20 miles to 95 miles, and the pattern can also shift from circular to ovalesque. There are points within this greater vortex that are stargates to infinity, but not all sites within the vortexial energy circulation are portals, and that is an important consideration, for portals are different in function than that termed a vortex. All portals have vortexes, but not all vortexes contain portals. Vortexes are complex, but may be crudely and simply defined as circulatory energies, usually formed when earth currents intersect or where specific mineralogies occur. Portals, however, are unique points of connection of gateways of transmission and receival. Some portals are what is termed stargates and connect what may be termed wormholes to a specific point in the cosmos. Others are infinity points, which are open gateways, offering unlimited connections to all dimensions, all realities. Some of these may lead to what is considered as external worlds, others as intra-realities. Masters, there are universes that exist in molecules. So to be clear, not every point within the greater vortex of Sedona is what may be termed an infinity point. And not every person who quests or meditates in the stargate of an infinity point within the vortex will be able to raise their frequency sufficiently to have the visionary experience. You see, the aperture of dimensional doorways within the energy of the portal points fluctuates through cosmic and astrological forces. access to stargates also varies within the specific vector of space-time continuum as to how these power nodes, infinity points, will define themselves according to where one stands based upon space and time. Does one stand upon the past, the future, the present? From which dimensional vector does one approach it? All of these influences change the physics and geometry with each variance. Accordingly, verification of how an individual perceives and experiences an infinity point will vary. A human primarily focused in third-dimensional reality will perceive and interpret based upon their light quotient, their individual system of belief, and level of awareness. The ability to raise one's vibration is essential, and this is only the beginning. The ability to rise into crystalline light body is also an important part of full utilization of infinity points. And so, another person may see the portal here or the transference of energy there, and they will interpret it differently from another. If one would approach the same portal from a coherent standpoint, it will define itself more clearly, and each place that you would stand, each varied stance, would offer to you a different perception and a different definition. One's purpose for questing, the attitude projected, must harmonize in perfect coherency with that termed the spirit of place. There are those, however well-intended, that speak of visiting PowerPoints for the purpose of activating them, aligning them, and anchoring them. In truth, it is the PowerPoint that activates, aligns, and anchors the human, and each human will receive this in a way tailored and defined by their light quotient, attitude, and system of belief. Infinity points involve all that you would term the crystalline codes, and much more as well that are not revealed. Much remains hidden from you in such vectors because humanity is not yet sufficiently perceptive. The ego brain attempts to apply 3D logic to a 12D experience. The 3D brain attempts to fit the new paradigm into what it already knows. But this cannot be done. The mathematics, the logarithms, the algorithms of infinity points cannot fit into limited 3D concepts. And so those who would attempt to fit the new concept into the old cannot open the doors. And of course, it cannot fit because the new earth and the upshifted power nodes are based upon a crystalline essence not yet understood by humanity, who remain tied to polarity magnetics. The better understanding of the cosmic matrix and the planetary interplay within vortexial portals and infinity points on your omni-Earth are waiting for the human group mind to expand a bit more into comprehension of the greater reality of the new Earth. Once you expand fully into the 33 chakric Merkana system, this will be accessible to you, and indeed for many of you, this has already occurred. We tell you that by visiting the nodes of Arizona and Arkansas, you will expedite this ability. 2014 and beyond. We would say to you that in 2014 and beyond, there is even greater light that circles about your planet now, wishing to enter into your mass field of awareness. It is light of a sublime nature. It does not hold 3D logic. It is not perceived in physical vision. And it is not the energy of pre-2012 magnetic Earth. Rather, it is the light of coherent crystalline expansion. And we will say to you that if you will allow this light to enter your sphere of influence, your field of awareness, you will find yourself lighter in spirit almost immediately. But this requires effort and intent. This subtle brilliance is available to humankind, to the individual who is dedicated to seek wisdom and growth. Wellness and self-love. One makes a quantum leap, a great surge unto mastery when one releases self-condemnation and guilt by engaging the light of self-love and wellness. Many of you, in seeking greater knowledge, do not always seek to include wellness and self-love, but you are synergistically required to do so to achieve the crystalline vibration. Self-love and wellness are complementary attributes of mastery. 2014, year for pilgrimage, questing, and recalibration. And so we emphasize that the experience of the pilgrimage, vision quest, fasting, and shamanic journey is of great benefit, in that the New Earth Matrix of 2014 and beyond is especially poignant for such noble quests. No site is better for this opportunity in the New Earth of 2014 than the Arizona Vortexial Portal. It is the crucible of purification. Masters, exploration of consciousness is requisite, and the review of self through the lens of the quest is truly necessary. We encourage all to find time for this activity, and in so doing, you will be offered a very potent opportunity of expansion. Indeed, the energies of the New Earth will absolutely amplify greater access to higher aspect and self-mastery. It has always been a habit of the wise soul to seek solitude for self-examination, for clearing and release, for the lifting into higher states of consciousness. It is the groundwork and mark of the serious seeker. It has always been so. The Harmonic Trigger and Stargate. In 2014, there is a unique and powerful chain of astrological energies that occur between March and June, and again between mid-October and December. This is an extraordinary timing for self-growth. From the apexial window of May 23rd to May 28th, the Sedona Vortex will be particularly embellished, and it is an incredibly beneficial time to pilgrimage to Sedona for gatherings in prayer, in ceremony, and meditation. The Stargate Portal is a unique phase in which coherency is increased, and one can merge more easily with the inner heart. The veil will be thinned, and codes received. Codes received in power nodes are a unique reflection of your divine pattern, for it is energy that you send, energy that you receive, energy that you speak, energy that you guide, and energy that guides you. That energy is crystalline light. It is the energy of your divine self. It finds flight in points of infinity, for these are teachers that serve your growth. And although points of light and infinity dot your planet and offer accelerated opportunity, we remind you that the most important sacred site is within you. It is your heart, and you carry it with you wherever you go. I am Metatron, and I share with you these truths. You are beloved. And so it is, and it is so. Accelerated opportunity. We remind you that the most
that didn't get backed up. Oops. There, right there. Okay, stop. Okay. I just want to read this because they had the five core crystalline codes. So we'll get it on the air here. Number one is the tetrahedron. This is the spirit science stuff, you know? Tetrahedron, four triangular facets, ruby ray red, divine will. Number two is hexahedron, and that's the cube. It's a six square faceted object, and it's divine creativity, and the color is orange. Number three is the octahedron, eight triangular facets, double pyramid, divine unity, and the color is golden sunshine yellow. Number four is the dodecahedron. That's a 12 pentagonal facets or polyhedral object, divine compassion. And the color is that emerald serpent feathered Quetzalcoatl green. And number five is the icosahedron, 20 triangular facets. It's a polyhedral also object. This time it's divine wisdom. And the color is royal Excalibur blue. So you've got those things on record there. That's powerful stuff. Wow, Rama, that was a good one. We're going to see about some, there's this collaboration with Tiburon with Richard Hoagland here. It's called Torsion Physics, Earthkeeper, WESAC. That would be really good to take a look at because we're coming up to WESAC here in May. So next week, get yourself ready for a treat, everyone.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, you think that there's a lack of stuff to learn. Don't ever think you'll know everything, because there's always plenty to learn. Unbelievable. Okay. So, yes, I think we will do our global spirit. What was that date again? 7-4 or something? Excuse me, I'll find it soon enough here. Now we're going to go to the Native American, because our brothers and sisters are helping the whole planet by bringing the attention to this Keystone Pipeline and to end that cuckoo nutsy thing. All right, so this is called Earth Wisdom for a World in Crisis. And then it says that this is, That got it all. Lost it. Oh, I know what I have to do. I have to press on it. Sorry, everybody. Now I got to go back there again. This happened at the United Nations a while back, but, you know, they're now out there at the, now they're in Washington, D.C. That's the same difference, yeah. Okay, everybody. Okay, here we go. Let's go put it in place.
I'm John Cleese. Do you realize that native peoples are largely responsible for the survival of the planet? Yes, because it's their forests that are still managing to offset some of the greenhouse gases from the major polluters like us. But although native peoples have the smallest ecological footprints, they unfortunately manage to suffer the worst impacts of climate change. It is their islands that are sinking and their glaciers that are melting, and they are not happy about it. Soon, we will be hearing directly from some of them as almost 3,000 indigenous delegates from around the world struggle to have their voices heard at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. So, settle back and take a deep breath as we venture to New York City with our trusted guide and host, Phil Cousineau, for a thoughtful, more documentary-style episode of Global Spirit, the first internal travel series.
Over 200 years ago, this part of Northern California was settled by the Spanish. Into this so-called New World, the conquerors brought with them a philosophy of complete domination of man over nature, which in turn has led to a relationship with the earth that is not sustainable. We now realize we are living on the edge of a worldwide environmental disaster. From the thinning ozone to the melting glaciers, life on Earth is in peril. Welcome to Earth Wisdom for a World in Crisis. Mount Tamalpais, just north of San Francisco, has been a sacred site to the Ohlone and Miwok tribes for over 5,000 years. I've heard from my Native American friends that there is a small shrine here which honors the spirit of the earth and the tribes who lived here before the arrival of the white man. The shrine honors Sitting Bull, a visionary chief of the Dakota Sioux. Sitting Bull was admired for his eloquent speeches, defending his people and their profound love for their ancestral land. Inscribed in a plaque and set in stone is one of Sitting Bull's prophetic warnings.
Behold, my brothers, the spring has come. Every seed is awakened, and so has all animal life. It is through this mysterious power that we too have our being. Yet hear me, people. We have now to deal with another race. They claim this mother of ours, the earth, for their own and fence their neighbors away. They deface her with their buildings and their refuse. That nation is like a spring that overruns its banks and destroys all who are in its path.
Sitting Bull, 1877. Could have written it yesterday. Yes, we have overrun our banks, and it appears more and more likely that it is the indigenous people of the world who have been living for thousands of years in balance with nature that can give us important insights on the dilemma we are in. I feel the time is running out, and I'm not alone. I'm here in New York this week because the United Nations has invited almost 3,000 indigenous people from all over the world to come to New York City, the symbolic heart of the Western commercial world, to share their native insights and possible solutions to the global environmental crisis.
We have really done a lot of mess with our earth, yeah? And I think it's payback time. We are paying. We are paying because of this, you see the tsunamis, you see like in Kenya sometimes there is this mudslides, and you see we have earthquakes. So we are paying back for the destruction we have been doing to the earth.
On my first day in New York, I'm very curious, is the UN actually ready to listen?
Aqui descobrimos também que este mundo moderno no tiene respuesta para muchas cosas. No tiene respuesta para la paz, para el desarrollo, porque está destruyendo la tierra, está destruyendo el medio ambiente. Y nosotros estamos avisando, estamos diciendo, está errado. No es así que se hace. Pero si no nos escuchan, ¿cómo vamos a transmitir eso?
Modernization is fine, but we should not lose out on our language, on our spiritual world. We should not lose out on our culture. And those are the reasons why we are here, to see whether we can find ways not to go back, but to see whether we can adapt them into the modern requirements. And that is not easy, but that is what we need to do.
Almost 3,000 indigenous people have traveled here at great effort and expense to make their recommendations on some of the major environmental issues of our time. Each representative has 3 minutes to make their case.
Nosotras las mujeres indígenas denunciamos las políticas públicas de deportación que causan la fragmentación de las familias y empujan al abandono de niños y jóvenes tanto en sus comunidades de origen como en las fronteras y en las áreas de dispersión urbana. La criminalización desaparición de los trabajadores indígenas ocurre a menudo debido a las políticas migratorias.
She's talking about the civilization of the indigenous people, and the discriminatory migratory, policies that fail to represent
que no reconocen los derechos humanos básicos.
Basic human rights and fundamental freedoms.
Christiana Seti Lua is from the small El Molo tribe in northern Kenya. During a lunch break in Central Park, I wanted to know what she came all this way to say to the United Nations.
First of all, my major concern was to bring my people into the picture of the world so that we can be recognized as a people, both locally, regionally, and internationally, and put the El Molo people in the map of the world where they belong with the other tribes of the world. And the other thing is to ensure that we are included in processes on matters affecting us.
Is the United Nations helping you feel more visible?
Yes. That is in fact why we need to participate in the forum, because here we have a voice just like any other government, any other community. So here we feel we belong.
Belonging and being heard are key, not only to the El Molo, but to all indigenous peoples who have historically been marginalized and made invisible. Ironically, now in the midst of a growing environmental crisis, they are finally being recognized by the UN as having something to offer. The United Nations estimates that there are approximately 370 million indigenous peoples in the world. They represent about 90 to 95% of the human genetic diversity of our planet. Chief Orrin Lyons of the Onondaga tribe in upstate New York opens the proceedings with a welcoming speech.
Now I ask all of our indigenous people from the four corners of the world to stand with me now and give you our profound thanks and appreciation for the adoption of the Declaration of the Indigenous Peoples, the Rights of the Indigenous Peoples of the World. It represents 30 years of work, and so all of our indigenous people, raise your hands. And we give you our profound thanks and appreciation.
Chief Orrin Lyons is a modern-day Sitting Bull. Orrin is an inspirational tribal leader, an orator, as well as an historian. I'm interested in Orrin's historical account of how the worldview of indigenous peoples first clashed with the worldview of their European colonizers.
In 1492, the Pope from Portugal issued a statement. And he said, to paraphrase the papal bull, we call them papal bulls, if there are no Christian nations in this new land that you find across this dark sea, then I declare the land to be open, empty, terra nullius, empty land, old Roman law. I declare the land to be empty and open to colonization by Christian nations. Further, if there are people there, and they are not Christians, then they do not have a right of title to land. They have only the right of occupancy. So we're saying now to the Holy See, you have to do more than disavow or rescind this racist doctrine. You have to be proactive. You have to come forward, and you have to confess to the American Indian people and all Native peoples in the world that you were wrong. Terrible injustice.
Orrin's point underscores the historic shift in approach towards indigenous peoples, from outright extermination to marginalization to having a voice here at the UN to finally state their concerns.
Estos días hemos tenido al frente a nosotros un convenio de estados, el de cambio climático, en el cual nuestros pueblos...
Okay, my people were not invited to take... to take part in this convention.
No son parte, pero sí nos concierne y nos afecta.
Yet we are affected. And we are connected, as has been shown by several generations, by indigenous groups. The matter must be re-examined because hanging in the balance is the very existence of indigenous people who are in danger of being displaced from ancestral lands and waters.
Y aguas ancestrales. Hay una ley, señora presidenta, que no está contemplada en...
There is a law that is not considered in the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
...de los derechos de los pueblos indígenas, pero que sí, mi pueblo, Collán Aymar...
Yet that my tribe... the Aymara, A-Y-M-A-R-A, respects.
La respeta, es la ley del Pachacuti, que quiere decir...
It is the law of Pachacuti, and it says the earth is in a time of recovery.
Que la tierra está en una época de cura, de curarse, y esa cura de la tierra...
In order to heal, just like us, the earth must rest.
Significa que la tierra debe descansar, así como nosotros.
The earth knows when it is time to rest.
Le decimos, señora presidenta,
we say, Madam President, that we must let the earth rest.
Todos que la tierra descanse para que nos siga protegiendo.
So that it can protect us in the future.
Gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you very much, Madam President.
Humanitarian organizations are trying their best to help. They often provide a bridge between indigenous peoples and their national governments. Brian Keene is an advocate for indigenous peoples and the co-founder of a nonprofit organization called Land is Life, which helps to bring indigenous peoples to New York to speak at these UN meetings.
Traditionally, indigenous peoples are seen as obstacles to development and what we consider in the West, we consider progress. And it's really the opposite is true. Indigenous peoples have knowledge, they have ways of living that they've practiced for thousands of years, which aren't based on profit or competition, but are based on reciprocity with nature. And so when we hear these problems of global warming, of biodiversity loss, what indigenous peoples are saying is that if you really want to find solutions, you're going to have to work with us because we know the environment better than anybody else. And we have our own technologies and our own knowledge and wisdom as to how to adapt to these changes that are happening. If you look at a map of the world where there's biodiversity hotspots, where there's clean riverine systems, where there's old growth forests, that's all in areas where indigenous peoples have managed to maintain control of their lands. This meeting is very important for indigenous peoples. It's a forum where they can make recommendations to the world's governments and to the United Nations. We bring indigenous peoples from around the world to participate, and we put on a training every year before the forum begins. First, so that they can participate effectively in the forum, they know how it functions, and to really take advantage of their 2 weeks here in New York.
Can you expand a little bit on Land is Life? It's a provocative phrase. What does it mean to you and to the people you're working with?
It means exactly what it says, land is life, where without land, indigenous peoples will not survive. The land is the basis of their spiritual sustenance. It's where they get their medicines, their foods, their building materials. They have a connection with the land that goes back millennia, and that's our work, is to help them to be able to continue on as cultures with that knowledge. And the only way to do that is to really secure the rights to the land. When they are removed from their lands, they end up migrating into cities, And when they arrive in the cities, they live on the outskirts, they live in the slums, or they live in the street, and there are no opportunities available for them. They often don't speak the language of the dominant society, so they're forced into slave labor, prostitution. There's hunger. People die from hunger. When they're removed from their lands, that's the final death toll, pretty much, for a culture.
The struggle for land rights involves indigenous peoples everywhere, including the United States. During my week in New York, I decided to attend a Native American celebration held in Inwood Hill Park, the last patch of old-growth forest on Manhattan Island. An old friend of mine, Chief Jake Swamp, a member of the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation, is being honored today for his environmental work. Jake is a spiritual leader as well as a man of action. He started a movement which became the Tree of Peace Society, which has generated the planting of millions of trees throughout the world. I am eager to show Jake something I discovered earlier that day in the park. This rock lies in the very spot where the Dutchman Peter Minuit supposedly purchased Manhattan Island from the local tribes for a handful of trinkets and beads worth about 60 Dutch guilders.
I really think it's a bad deal. If it was illegal at all, I wonder if anybody's got the receipt.
Yes.
If nobody has a receipt for it, then maybe it's not illegal. Can you get a refund? I hope you can get it back. And we're told here that this little slice of land is the last 160 acres in Manhattan of natural growth forest. This is it. Well, that's indicative of what's happening around the world. We're running out of resources and places where we can reach out and go back to ancient times to have a connection. If we followed the teachings of the ancient ones, they knew that their lives depended upon nature, that everything they derived from nature supported their lives. And somehow, throughout history, somehow, people went astray and they forgot their original teachings.
Gloria Ushiquat from the Ecuadorian Amazon has a direct, profound connection to the land. As a child, she was identified by her tribal elders as a shaman, a visionary. Gloria is well known throughout her territory and internationally for helping to halt the plundering of her people's land by foreign oil companies. Gloria Ushiquat is here to represent her people at the UN.
Bueno, mi papel es lo que ellos me nombraron.
The role I have been assigned by my people is to take care of all the territory of the jungle. To prevent people from cutting it down and causing harm.
Otras personas que haga daño. Eso es mi trabajo.
This is the job my people entrusted
ahora,
me with.
Mi pueblo. Abajo del agua estamos cuidando ahora.
Now, we are working on protecting our water
que
resources.
No pueden entrar otras personas.
We are defending our resources.
Que no puede entrar.
Oh, just a second. So our water, we are protecting our water resources.
No pueden ingresar otras personas.
We are defending our resources so
no one
can exploit them.
Que no puede entrar,
So the petroleum, which is the worst thing in the world, cannot get in the water.
El petróleo que son más malos del mundo que yo no quiero, por eso lo que estamos ahí.
That is what we are working on now. Oh, yet it will take time.
Un poquito más.
Many indigenous peoples see Gloria as an inspiring example of using shamanic powers against the environmentally destructive actions of outsiders.
Las otras personas ya quieren hacer otras cosas. Ellos quieren ver.
There are people who want to profit from our land. They want to sell it because they think it's free. Because there are so few of us.
Bueno, también hay una cosa.
So occasionally, I have to do some bad things. We played this before, but it's so powerful. I'm just playing it again, everybody.
Okay. Yes, algunas cosas malas.
Yet, I have to do it for my people.
Para la gente, para otra gente que están entrando.
When outsiders come into our territory.
En mi territorio. Y para cuidar a él.
To stop them, I sometimes have to work with spirits that are bad.
Toca meter otros espíritus un poquito malo. Meter en, aunque sea con algún.
I have to, what is it? I have to call upon bad spirits.
Like a serpent.
Una cosa. Y ellos quieren trabajar.
Ooh, she's got one of those really poisonous spiders on her. When the intruders come here, the insects bite them or bother them.
Esos bichos tienes que molestar o morderlos para que tengan un poco miedo.
In order to frighten them away.
Can you tell us what spirits are in the earth? Can you describe them for us?
You mean what do they look like? Well, the plant and the earth spirits are different than the water spirits.
La cara es muy diferente.
They have different faces, their eyes, their teeth are like.
Los ojos, los dientes, son como, ¿cómo puedo decir? Algunos animales que.
Like some animals with fangs, and they're showing a very poisonous snake there, and then they had a leopard there. Fangs that point up and down.
De estos tiene hasta acá arriba, uno tiene para abajo, y ellos son de los plantas.
They come from plants, too.
Muy poderoso.
They are very powerful. With this plant that she's showing, you can see things.
Ah.
After someone eats the plant, is that ayahuasca? Is that what that is? You can communicate with them.
Hablando. Puedes hablar.
You can speak to a person about. About whatever you want.
Cualquier cosa ellos responden, pero.
When people eat the plant, they will tell you the truth.
Responder muy verdad. Va a pasar eso.
The worldview of indigenous peoples like Gloria's is often difficult for people in the industrialized world to fully understand. For centuries, the same has been true for the earth wisdom of the native peoples in the United States.
When I first started out going to universities, we were kind of made fun of, you know, the way we were talking about Mother Earth.
They say, why don't you stop talking about old wives' tales and why don't you get yourself an education and be with it?
What was your response? What did you say to them?
Well, inside, my stomach was just turning, but I can't show it. I have to think because I know they don't know.
They asked me one time, well, what's your bottom line? What's your bottom line, Chief? I said, I don't know. They said, everybody's got a bottom line. Really? See, wait, let me think about this. I said, I don't know. Nobody ever asked me that question before. What's my bottom line? So I thought about it. I said, I got to be careful with this answer. Serious question. Because bottom line indicates economy. Basically, it's an economic statement, you know. Bottom line is profit or loss. After all the figuring and the figures come to the bottom line. I thought about it and I said, well, prior to them coming over here, we didn't have a bottom line. And I said, we don't have a bottom line. So I said, that's my answer. We don't have a bottom line. He says, well, everybody, no, I said, we live in a cycle. Spring, summer, fall, winter, spring, summer. There's no bottom line.
Para nuestra cosmovisión, todo.
In our cosmovision, everything turns, everything revolves, it cycles.
Todo es rotativo.
This is Thomas Alarcon. That was Chief Lyons that just spoke before.
Es como la...
This guy is the advocate of the Amaya tribe. Aymara tribe. They're from Peru.
Da vueltas alrededor del sol.
So the earth revolves around the sun.
Entonces, bajo ese concepto,
then under this concept, there are times when the earth suffers.
Hay momentos que la tierra sufre y hay momentos que la tierra florece.
And there are times when the earth flourishes.
Hay momentos que la tierra descansa.
There are moments when the earth rests.
Entonces, hemos pasado una época.
So we have entered a period where the earth has become tired of being exploited,
de ser explotada, de ser saqueado sus recursos,
of having its resources taken, of having its mountains moved.
When people forget the original spirit or the teachings, what happens is we have a breakdown of society because the feeling we had with nature is normally feeling good. But when you divorce yourself from that feeling good feeling, then what happens is you start feeling sad and lonesome and you're craving to find that again.
Queremos que
we want people and international companies,
la gente y las compañías transnacionales entiendan esta cosmovisión,
to understand this cosmovision.
Si ellos no van a entender,
because as they do not understand our spirits that are more powerful than they are more powerful than international companies, these spirits are going to cause many difficulties. We must respect nature. Water is indeed sacred because it comes from the sky.
Porque viene del cielo.
I just wanted to remind you that Cancer, Jupiter in Cancer, it's a mixture Cancer of water and air. And he's saying it right here. Water is sacred because it comes from the sky, an Aram element here. Okay.
Baja a la tierra,
it falls to earth and penetrates the mountains. Then it leaves for the sea and rises again. And it's so it gives us life. For us, this natural cycle is sacred.
And this is the cycle, the sacred cycle of the world. We cannot interrupt this cycle.
So when you grow up with the idea that there's always a better place, always another place, and this place here suffers the consequence of that kind of thinking. And now, not only this place, but everybody, all humanity, suffer the consequence of that thinking today. Now we're facing a reality and the consequence of our disregarding the laws of the earth.
The knowledge we believe in is not just philosophical. This is Marcos Terena, and he represents, what's that first word? It begins with an X, Rama. Well, spell it.
X-A-N-C.
X-A-N-C. Yank, tribal leader from Brazil.
Uma base filosófica que viene de la naturaleza.
Our knowledge derives from nature and the environment.
Esta fuerza,
it is knowledge of the force.
Vientos,
it can be found in the wind. Rain, rocks, rivers, and mountains. I am not talking about conservation or preservation. Yet, about utilizing this knowledge of, what's that word, honey? Or what they call here, science, I see.
Para mejorar la vida.
To improve everyone's life.
Difficulties can escalate to conflict when the issue involves ownership of land. Here in Chiapas, Mexico, a confrontation erupts between native peoples and the Mexican government, which wants to extract oil and other natural resources from indigenous land. This tragic drama is being played out all over the world, though rarely like this, in the presence of a video camera, where the camera itself can affect the actual outcome. Native people all over the globe have decided that the fight for their lands can no longer be fought in isolation. Whether in front of video cameras or at the United Nations, they are expressing an urgent need to be heard. The quiet hallway outside the UN chambers is an impressive exhibit by indigenous artists. I feel like I'm looking at images from a disappearing world. The theme is global warming and what's at stake for these caretakers of the earth. Images from the vanishing rainforest to the melting tundra and the plight of the reindeer herding Sami, one of Europe's few surviving indigenous groups.
We are divided by four borders, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. And we have been there since as long as we can remember, prior to the Scandinavians and Russians arriving to that part of the world.
And what role do the reindeer play?
The reindeer herding is extremely important as a culture, a carrier of culture, because also in reindeer herding you have the very strong connection, the coupled connection, you know, between animal and nature and human being. It's a symbiosis in a way.
Is there any danger with
the reindeer at this point?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. Because the snow is, well, it's disappearing, and also it gets frozen in a way so the reindeer cannot access their food. And we had a huge disaster last year, and we've also had a disaster this year because a lot of reindeer just starved to death because they can't access the lichen anymore. So it is a growing problem.
Is it possible to still gain access to the old ways of the Sami?
Yeah. It's very connected still to the land also. We have old sacred sites. But now we've had quite a lot of trouble with tourism exploiting those sacred sites. And so we don't have any kind of protection to protect them from being violated by people. So
I just want to tell you her name is Christine Nordling, and she's from Sami land, northern Norway. And I'm just going to tell you, she's got blonde, white blonde braids down to her butt. It's just a very striking for this Nordic, northern Sami indigenous person's looks, just to tell you that.
It's deeply related to rights to land, actually.
Everything at the UN seems to move at glacial speed. Delegates are bogged down by rules and time limits. Their recommendations must refer to points in previous declarations. In this arena, seemingly small details, like the difference between people and peoples, can have major political implications.
Young indigenous people.
It was a very long struggle to get the S onto indigenous people within the UN system. What does the S mean? Well, if you talk about indigenous people have rights, then it would be like, you know, individual indigenous people have rights. They have the right to a nationality. They can become president of their country. They can own a business. They can, you know, they have rights like everybody else. But what we're talking about when we put the S on the end is collective rights. It's basically indigenous people's rights is self-determination and collective ownership of lands, resources, and knowledge. They need to have collective ownership of their lands, because if it's divided up and given to individual indigenous people, then it can be bought and sold and divided, and little by little they will lose their land. If they have collective ownership of the land, that can't happen. Same with collective ownership of knowledge. You have ethnobotanists around the world in indigenous communities, often working for pharmaceutical companies, and they go to the healers and the shaman, and they say, you know, we want to cure sick people. Can you help us? And the shamans give freely of their knowledge because, of course, they want to help people. But what the shamans don't understand is that these companies that acquire the knowledge, they take the medicinal plants, they find the active properties of that plant, and then they patent them. And so now they're the owners of that medicine, legally, in the Western system. I think the latest estimate of the United Nations was that the value of medicines developed with indigenous knowledge is over $80 billion a year. And out of that $80 billion a year, indigenous peoples receive less than 1/1,000th of 1%. So the shaman who gives the knowledge for the next wonder drug, he might get a tin roof on his hut, a tin roof that he doesn't need. He might get a motor for his canoe. He might get a soccer ball and a t-shirt or something like that.
Victor Kaisepo is from the Biak tribe of West Papua and reports on how Biak earth wisdom gets converted into intellectual property.
Kaffa is a plant that you can drink and that can relax your system. And when you relax, then you can get into communication with your ancestors. But on the island, people drink kava just to relax. But in this country, in the USA, they make it a pill out of it, and they call it kava kava. They patent it, and they earn them. And so sometimes indigenous peoples, with the technology, tend to not to protect them. And that's why here we are talking about intellectual property rights, to ensure that whatever is coming from our collective intellectual property, that if should there be any gain, then we would like to have part of that.
We, the Indigenous Youth of Australia, believe there is no one solution to these issues facing our communities, and we need and require a holistic approach from all levels of government, working in partnership with our communities.
The hope of many Indigenous peoples who come to New York is that the UN, along with their own national delegates, will take their recommendations seriously and adjust their laws and policies.
But, you know, sometimes the expectations are too high. And, you know, the special rapporteur can only make reports. He cannot, really force the governments or the UN to do something. So this in fact, leads me to say that despite the fact that for the last 7 years the permanent forum has been on, so many communities have made their recommendations and appealed to the UN, to the governments and all. But so far, nothing has been done, really. You see? It feels frustrating. We come talk. Sometimes I really fear if it's just going to be some empty rhetoric and nothing be done. But we still have hope that something will come out of this. Yeah.
Talking with Christiana in Central Park makes me wonder if all the long journeys, all the high hopes and heartfelt testimonials are actually making any difference. Are the government delegates really listening?
It's interesting to me, you know, listening to the conversations of states responding to the indigenous discussions here. And the states are saying, yes, we're concerned about how you're faring, and that you know, your poverty, and we're going to try to help you, you know, in this crisis of global warming, as if they were exempt, as if they were somehow going to be in another world. They don't seem to realize how democratic this event is going to be. You're going to see democracy at work here. There's no place to run. There's no place to go. And what you have is one earth. If you don't take care of that, you suffer the consequence.
Let me put it this way. If I want to build a canoe, I just need one tree. I wonder why 10,000 hectares of forest need to be cleared. So where are these other canoes being built? Now, this is the way of life that we have in our relationship with the land, with the sea, with the rivers, and all the living spaces in there. The forest, so to speak, is our grocery store. That's where we get our medicinal plants. That's where our ancestors are living. That's why we buried our death. So it's much more than just protecting a tree. And that's why sometimes the mainstream society will not recognize us as a contribution to protect the area. If we say protected areas, we already protected by principle because our survival depends on well-being of the forest.
Just 58 years ago, 1950, there were 2.5 billion people in the world. 58 years later, we got 6.7 billion. That's not sustainable. That's way out of balance. We're eating the very surface of the earth. We're displacing animals. We're displacing birds, habitat. The elephants are in a very narrow corridor. You can count the tigers. You can count the gorillas. We've polluted the whole ocean. Those are big systems. Once you do that to the system, you're not about to fix it. There's nothing fixable there. If you just envision 6.7 billion human heads all functioning and all thinking that everything revolves in my head around me. That's your ego. And if you step back and look at them as a species, it's a, that's a problem. The whole universe is in balance. It's always in the process of balancing itself. It's a work in progress.
Do human beings and nature mirror each other?
We are nature. We're not separate from it. You'd see, you know, the question separates us from the no. We are nature. That's us. Nature is us. Was that Pogo said that?
That's one of our great philosophers.
Well, that's an interesting observation, though. He said, I have seen the enemy, and the enemy is us.
Yes, indeed. Too often the enemy is us. Once again, I'm hearing echoes of Sitting Bull when he spoke about the white man.
They claim this mother of ours, the earth, for their own and fence their neighbors away. They deface her with their buildings and their refuse.
All this makes me wonder just where we went wrong.
The spirit of the people when they dance, especially the drum. That's what it's for. It's the heartbeat of Mother Earth, you know. It goes in relationship with the earth, and it's rhythm. And so when the drum is sung, it's just like the earth singing. And the people are showing how happy they are to be part of this beautiful nature.
We're going to do a short Thanksgiving address. Number one, the Creator, the one that's in every living thing, including the trees. Everything that lives in its total is what we call Creator power. That's the one that made the universe where we live. And so we say thank you to our Creator for allowing us a safe journey to share each other's company. And we say, Creator, thank you with love. And our mind is agreed.
What's the importance of the Thanksgiving prayer? To uplift the minds of the people. Because in our world, we have many people who are suffering from grief caused by war or maybe a family breakdown, maybe the losses of children through drugs and alcohol abuse. We have many ways to describe what it feels like when you fall into this the clutches of grief.
This earth that you are standing on and sitting on her, that's the one the Creator said is going to be our Mother Earth. She is the mother of the trees, and she is the mother of the deers and the buffaloes, and she's the mother of the birds, and she's the mother of all people, of all nations. Mother Earth, we say thank you with love today, and our mind is agreed. Also, the Creator made the rivers and the waters, and that waters is not just water. That water has a living spirit in it. And so this water is moving all the time in the tides of the ocean, and the streams of the rivers and the creeks. And it is looking to find our villages and our community where we live so it can quench our thirst every day. And so what I'm suggesting today is that all of us here gathered, that we put it in front of us on this beautiful lawn, many thank yous, layer upon layer, and we will throw some to the east, some to the north, some to the west, some to the south, until every pond, every river, every creek, every ocean has received our thank you, our greetings and our love for the quenching of our thirst today and yesterday. And so to the waters of the world, your human relatives with love says thank you today, and our mind is agreed.
Thank you, water. You're still flowing in your different directions. You did not stop regardless of how sad I feel today. When I look at you, you're still flowing. I can say to myself, life is continuing, and I can feel better.
I can feel better when I say thank you, birds, for singing your beautiful songs, for to comfort my mind. Thank you, trees, for providing the shade in the hot summer months. And so there's many different ways you can use nature through the thanksgiving of nature to comfort your own heart, your own mind, so that you can go on in life without too much distractions and not falling into sadness all the time. Because we're really here on Earth to be happy and to have fun.
Les Touaregs ont aujourd'hui à subir les effets de la mondialisation.
The Touareg are now subject to the consequences of globalization.
Nous pensons que ce processus va conduire.
We fear that this process will result in the disappearance
d'un mode de vie ancestral adapté à l'environnement.
Of traditional ways of life. Adapted to the environment, the ancestral lands of our nomadic people are destroyed. Our villages raped and burned, raided and burned.
I've been in New York all week at the UN, the gathering of indigenous peoples around the world, and I thought for sure that the New York Times would have covered this, but there has been nothing, no coverage all week. And I've had a few conversations with people from indigenous countries and cultures, and they're as frustrated as I am. They have come halfway around the world, certain that the New York Times, greatest newspaper in the world, would have covered the story, and they're not. Apparently, the desk told one of the representatives at the UN that it wasn't a story.
When you come here to New York,
la tierra no puede.
You feel the earth cannot breathe.
Todo está cubierto.
Everything is covered.
¿Dónde va a poner su, dónde va a...
Where can the spirit rest?
Ah. ¿Y dónde...
Where can I talk? Where can I talk with people?
Zona. No tiene lugar aquí.
It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have a place here. We, the indigenous people, must help with this system to find solutions that will indeed work for all humanity, not only for us, indigenous people. Modern. Just hold on a second, everybody. Modern science sends satellites.
Satellites up al cielo, but
into the sky to hear something different.
Pero espíritu de la tierra.
Yet the earth's spirit doesn't need to go up there.
No tiene que ir allá para escuchar el corazón de la tierra.
One second. To listen to its own heartbeat.
Puede usted estar sentado ahí.
You can be sitting here.
escuchar,
and hear or feel the wind.
El viento, ¿no? Y escuchar,
and listen to the heart of the earth.
Y por eso, tenemos.
And also, we must share this information with those who are not indigenous.
Información a los que no son indígenas. ¿Y cómo hacerlo?
Yet how can we do that as they are not ready to listen?
Para escuchar.
When the delegates return to adopt the final report, something appears to be going very wrong. Frustrations are boiling over. The UN security police are called in to quell the disturbance.
Most indigenous peoples here are not in agreement with some of the recommendations that the forum made concerning climate change, specifically with regard to carbon trading schemes. So they're trying to get two paragraphs taken out of the final recommendations.
They want to speak for 3 minutes, and I think it's right to give them the 3 minutes. Don't take to the principle. Just give them the moment to speak.
Time seems to be running out for the conference. To keep the peace, Madam Chair agrees to bend the rules, and the speech is allowed. It's a small but important victory.
Silencio, por favor. Silencio. Pase. Pase.
Muchas gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you, Madam President. We had a fight for 3 minutes. On behalf of the Caucus of Indigenous Peoples,
del caucus indígena, queremos manifestar nuestra preocupación.
We would like to express our concerns regarding their recommendations.
Naciones adoptadas relacionadas al tema central
of the 7th session of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues.
Sobre las cuestiones indígenas. Los pueblos indígenas reiteramos que son.
We, the indigenous peoples, reaffirm
titulares de nuestros territorios. Asimismo, somos dueños de nuestros conocimientos,
of our lands, of our knowledge,
innovaciones y
our innovations and our practices.
Y rechazamos las nuevas políticas.
And we reject the policies of the government, of the governments that exploit our cultures.
Bosques, aguas y biodiversidad.
Our forests, our waters, and our biodiversity that we have preserved for the benefit of all humanity.
Cuando llegamos aquí,
when we come here to the forum, we are given 3 minutes
dentro del foro permanente para hablar sobre una
to speak about our history of at least the past 500 years.
¿Cómo es posible?
How is it possible to hear our concerns in 3 minutes?
¿Y cómo podemos también?
And how is it possible for us to explain our concerns
minutos
in 3 minutes? It is impossible.
No recoge las propuestas.
In this report,
pasiones del
there is no mention
indígenas
of the concerns and proposals of the indigenous peoples regarding the emissions reduction
de
initiatives, deforestation. Say, is that right? Initiatives, deforestation.
For deforestation in países de desarrollo con
migration, plans for clean
como red.
development
and carbon trading. Y el mercado de carbono. También nos preocupa que
additionally, we are concerned that the initiatives for clean development are considered to be examples of good practice. Therefore, we, just a second. We reiterate our request to completely eliminate paragraphs 5 and 37. Lastly, we are before the president to request that you wait to act.
A la presidenta, disculpe, que conste en el acta y
and annex the report of our declarations and position.
Gracias, señora.
Thank you very much, Madam President.
A powerful climax to an amazing week. The Indigenous Caucus seems hopeful that their concerns will be implemented.
Before any action is taken, you usually have to get it on paper in the Occidental world, right? So before there's action on respecting Indigenous people's rights, you need countries to recognize those rights in constitutions and in national laws. It's one struggle to get it on paper, and then the next step is to get it acted upon, and that's the harder part.
The diligent record-keeping of the UN is truly impressive. Every word and recommendation is recorded and published in 6 languages. The transcripts are available to anyone with the time and the interest to read them. But what do all the reports amount to anyway? Will any real and constructive change come out of these hearings? And how about the earth wisdom of these proud and passionate people that we heard from this week? Are we and our leaders open to receive it? How can this documentary that we've made actually make a difference?
You see, the United Nations is a close, but in your media, we can speak to all of humanity. That's for us. I told you, thank you very much for this opportunity. And this is very important for us.
It feels good because at least we have achieved something so far. To bring our community to be known, to be heard, to be seen. That's a step. It's a big, big step from all the way, halfway across the world, yeah.
I think culturally, spiritually, we are called upon to contribute to safeguard this planet. And I love the idea that it's been brought together.
H.G. Wells once said, "History is a race between education and catastrophe." It makes me wonder if we've had enough time to educate ourselves before it's too late. Back home, I feel the need to return to the Sitting Bull Shrine to reflect on all that's been expressed during this past week. And I'm wondering, is anyone listening? I'm still hearing all of their voices.
We're at a tipping point. You know, in the time of the Earth itself, you know, we're beyond the millisecond, we're beyond all of that. The time is here, it's now.
I believe Indigenous peoples can contribute to mankind. If mankind is open to receive, if not, we cannot contribute.
Los espíritus siempre están.
Spirits are always behind us. They let us know as we should say yes or no. The secret is to help the people hear them.
As I listen for some message from the great orator in chief, I hear instead the words of Sitting Bull's modern counterpart, Chief Orrin Lyons.
He had a lot of trouble. I mean, wake up, America. Wake up, world. And then you ask the Indian, can you fix it?
Hello, I continue to be John Cleese. Yes, indeed, looking at Sitting Bull, one does wonder, can anyone really fix it? And with China and India now having joined the world's major polluter club, how will our shrinking forests absorb all the yuck that we're putting into the air? Sadly, since this program was made, both Chief Jake Swamp, the man who inspired the planting of over 200 million trees worldwide, and Victor Kaisepa, a longtime advocate of indigenous peoples' rights in West Papua, have passed. Their voices will be missed, but we can hope that they have inspired others to take up the baton. I hope that you're enjoying this unique series and very much hope that you will be joining us again soon for another episode of Global Spirit, the first internal travel series.
Okay, everybody, we're going to go on now. Thank you for listening to that. There may be many of you that didn't hear it the first time. Okay, second here. Maybe if you say
something.
I have to find what I'm looking for.
We're getting there.
You want to make a drama?
That was very awesome what they were talking about, because I know that then you talk to this spirit molecule, all the five elements, including ether, working in unison with Gaia Vaiwamas, things happen.
Magic happens. Okay, now we're going to go to Abby.
Now we're going to go to Abby Martin.
Happy World Penguin Day, people. I'm Abby Martin, and this is Breaking the Set. See, the Marshall Islands is a country made up of over 1,100 isolated islands with a population of just over 68,000 people. But earlier this week, the tiny Pacific nation made waves by taking on the world's superpowers in an unprecedented international lawsuit filed at The Hague. On Wednesday, the country sued the U.S., Russia, the U.K., France, China, Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea over their flagrant violation of international law when it comes to the 1958 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. According to the lawsuit, the Marshall Islands are claiming that all of these nuclear-armed countries are actually modernizing their warheads instead of disarming them. See, the Marshall Islands has a particular dog in the fight when it comes to ridding the world of these mass-killing machines. Between 1946 and 1958, the U.S. tested 67 nuclear weapons on the islands. And in 1956, the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission designated the islands the most contaminated place on Earth. And although this is no doubt a David v. Goliath battle, this lawsuit sheds a much-needed light on the failure of these countries to adequately reduce their nuclear stockpiles. Because although exact numbers are impossible to know, according to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Group Plowshares Fund, the world still has over 17,000 nuclear weapons, including 8,500 in Russia and 7,700 in the U.S., more than enough to wipe out humanity many times over. Comforting thought. Technological insanity. So if you support the Marshall Islands in its quest for a nuclear-free world, then join me, and let's break the set. environmental issue has generated more controversy than the Keystone XL oil pipeline. The proposed southern leg of the pipeline would carry over 800,000 barrels of tar sands crude oil a day through 1,200 miles of pipe to refineries in the Gulf of Mexico. 4 years, Keystone supporters and critics have awaited a decision from the Obama administration over whether this phase of the pipeline will be approved. And last week, the State Department announced that it would be delaying its decision once again until after the midterm elections, citing the murky legality of building the pipeline through Nebraska. But one major aspect of the debate that has been largely ignored by the establishment press is the effect this pipeline will have on the Native Americans, ranchers, and farmers residing in the states Keystone will pass through. Well, this week, a group calling themselves the Cowboy and Indian Alliance have taken to the streets of downtown D.C. to voice their concern over Keystone's potential construction. Take a listen.
Keystone XL is now pushing its way through. With the devastation that it's already created in Canada, it's now targeting us and going down into my relatives' lands down here. They're having to face the same thing as we did in all these centuries of devastation of our earth, where the white man would come through and just take what he wanted. Now he's turned on his own.
So to talk about the indigenous movement against Keystone XL, I'm joined now by Clayton Thomas Muller of the Matthias Column Nation, Sundance Chief Reuben George of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, and Crystal Lammerman of the Beaver Lake Cree Nation. Thank you so much, you guys, for coming on. Let's start with you, Clayton. The movement to reject and protect has been rallying in D.C. since Monday. Can you talk about some of the actions that have taken place so far?
Absolutely. On the first day of our week of sustained actions on the National Mall, we have a teepee village that we've erected, as well as a old-time covered wagon that we brought in, representing an unprecedented alliance that has emerged between landowners in the state of Nebraska and Native American nations from South Dakota, to send a very direct message to President Obama on the eve of his decision, yay or nay, on the Keystone XL pipeline. The objective of this week, of course, was to ratchet up pressure through the use of direct action and in some pretty slick media organizing. So we've done a procession down the Washington Mall with horseback, cowboys and Indians riding horses together. We've had ceremony, and we've also done a direct action at the Reflection Pond in front of the Lincoln Memorial and at Senator Kerry's house this morning. We went and had a prayer circle, or not Senator Kerry, forgive me, Secretary of State Kerry's house, which was followed by a round dance in one of the capital city's biggest intersections.
Amazing. I love that you guys did that right at his doorstep. Can you also break down some of the legal battles that the Keystone's facing in Nebraska and elsewhere?
Absolutely. There's a very high-profile case in the courts of Nebraska right now that has directly challenged the attempts of TransCanada Pipeline Corporation to identify a route through the state of Nebraska. This has created a legal barrier has, you know, created some political liabilities in terms of the White House making a decision on this. But there are also other legal frameworks at play right now, including the Minnewachoni Water Delivery System in the state of South Dakota, which provides 56,000 citizens in that state with their water per day. The pipeline, if built, would cross it in 56 intersections, as well as the Delaware River. And this infrastructure is owned by the Oglala Sioux Nation, a sovereign nation within the United States. And so there are many legal ramifications of both legal actions from tribal folks and from landowners that have got President Obama worried.
Crystal, let's talk about the issue of sovereignty here. Another huge issue is the violation of centuries-old treaties between Indigenous peoples and the government. Can you speak to exactly what treaties are being violated?
Well, every single agreement within those treaties has been violated. From the time that these treaty agreements were entered into, right across Turtle Island, the nation that I come from is Treaty 6, which was entered into in 1876. And every single agreement that we have entered into as the first peoples of this land, we are the only ones, you know, on the other side of the treaty that are not, we're not benefiting from those treaties, but those folks that we entered into, you know, our visitors when they came over here, they're the ones that are benefiting. And so the people, you know, have come here, and I'm here as a First Nations woman of Canada, you know, from Treaty 6 in Northern Alberta, an impacted community of the tar sands, which is going to, you know, this is what's going to be carried through this pipeline. And I'm here as a First Nations woman from Canada to remind not only my government up there in Canada and the British Crown that we entered into those agreements with, but also to remind this government as well that as First Nations people who have treaty agreements, that we have the constitutional power to stop these pipelines, and we have the constitutional power to stop these pipelines at the source. You know, this is no longer an Indian problem anymore. This is a human problem. This is an everybody problem. You know, the water is being poisoned. The land is being poisoned.
Right. I mean, these treaties supersede everything else. People don't really realize that. Ruben, let's turn to you. The cooperation between farmers and people of First Nations is absolutely amazing, incredible here. Is this unlikely partnership, or at least was unlikely until now, is what's going to take to stop Keystone once and for all? Because really looking at the Democratic establishment, we cannot trust them to stand up to the oil companies here.
Well, Indigenous people, we've been doing what we've been doing for thousands of years, and that's being stewards of our land and work in cooperation, not just with the ranchers. It's like my friend Crystal here said, it's everybody's problem. It's something that we need to look at and something that we need to address. Our Canadian and American governments have taken action to move towards developing these pipelines is wrong. They say it's for green, it's for jobs. That's wrong. There's 31 more jobs and green energy jobs. They say it's for economy. You look at Portugal, 70% of their energy is renewable energy. There's green energy alternatives. So it's everybody's problem that we need to address. We need to work together and we need to make some big decisions.
You're right. It does affect everyone. Clayton, let's turn to you. Alberta's Energy East pipeline, arguably worse than Keystone. What effects had this pipeline had already in Canada?
Well, the effects of the proposed TransCanada Energy East pipeline is that it's created more pressure on President Obama. It's a clear demonstration of the desperation of both TransCanada Pipeline Corporation, big oil operating in Canada's tar sands, and our own Prime Minister Harper, because they are desperate to get this landlocked resource, this stranded economic asset, to any international market vis-a-vis pipelines. But it's in northern Alberta. There's no infrastructure to get it out right now. And so due to the immense movement, the lightning rod of the environmental movement that the Keystone XL campaign has become and the emergence of the Cowboy Indian Alliance, we now see these companies looking to divide us with multiple proposals of pipelines to try and get the tar sands out of Alberta. And so the repercussions of that, of course, is that Prime Minister Harper can look forward to many large-scale mobilizations like what we're seeing here in Washington, D.C. during the Reject and Protect actions.
And speaking of the Canadian government trying to draw in the U.S. corporations and get Obama on board with all of this. I mean, they are. Connect to Canada, this campaign. Ruben, you've done work to stop another pipeline proposed by Kinder Morgan, an American energy company. How will that affect your nation's land?
It is devastating already with the development that's already going through Vancouver and our ports. If you look at Exxon Valdez, 25 years later, that company is still trying not to pay compensation. They're still in court today trying not to pay compensation. Those are things that we don't want happening, not only in our territory, and that's why we're creating alliances with Indigenous people all over British Columbia. 170 nations signed the Save the Fraser Declaration. There is also a treaty made between the Pawnee and the Lakota to come together. We're also creating a treaty to bring together the Salish nations from Washington State into British Columbia. It's devastating. When even if the pipeline and everything and the tankers get through and it's safe, it still leaves Canada to be the number one polluter in our atmosphere. And we would like to remind Americans, this is not an American company. This is a Canadian company that's coming in and trying to cause this destruction to the lands here.
Crystal, it is time to unite everyone against this pipeline. Talk about the action in D.C. tomorrow and how people can get involved.
So what's happening tomorrow, I believe we're starting at 11 out there In the encampment, I said, I think that we're actually going over, and then we're going to be surrounding the White House. And I think that, you know, this goes to that the whole context of this conversation, that this isn't everybody's problem. So if you're in the D.C. area, you know, take the time to come down there and make this your issue as well. And as you, for the folks that are out there that can't be there, you know, utilize the social media, tweet about it, you know, read about it. You know, when you talk about the treaty obligations, you know, I'm here, you know, enforcing and reminding these governments that my nation has entered into litigation around treaty as well.
You guys certainly are. Thank you so much for fighting this pipeline, for being here, sending Obama a very clear message here. Clayton, Ruben, Crystal, really appreciate you guys coming on.
Thank you for having
us.
Coming up, you guys, I'll talk about how the war on poverty has turned into the war against the poor. As if being homeless wasn't hard enough, there's now a growing trend of local laws across America turning homelessness into a criminal offense. Take, for instance, Bakersfield, California, where an aggressive ban on begging is set to take effect, making panhandling near businesses a misdemeanor. But the Bakersfield law is only one example of how communities are clamping down on homelessness. In the heart of Silicon Valley in Palo Alto, California, local lawmakers have enacted a law that actually bans sleeping in cars. That's right. Sleeping in something that you own could potentially lead you to 6 months in jail or a $1,000 fine under the argument that it damages the city's quality of life. And by city, I mean the 1%. Because depriving the poor of their last option for shelter certainly isn't protecting their quality of life. The end goal of these so-called quality of life laws is to make these cities practically impossible to live in for those who can't afford it. And what's worse is that these types of laws are expanding nationwide. According to a survey of 234 cities by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, 40% of the cities polled upheld bans on sleeping in public, 33% banned sitting, and upwards of 50% of cities have laws against panhandling. Wow. These stats paint a picture of an all-out legal assault on homelessness. But unfortunately, it doesn't stop there. In dozens of other towns, ordinances go as far as banning people from even helping the poor. For example, in Birmingham, Alabama, a Christian ministry is being blocked by police for handing out hot dogs and bottled water, citing the need to have a $500 permit to distribute food from a vehicle. The same is true in cities like Dallas, Philadelphia, and even New York City. In New York, a ban on food donations to homeless shelters is being justified because, get this, the city simply cannot assess the salt, fat, and fiber content in the food. Right. So, with corporate profits at a record high and income inequality in America growing faster than any other industrialized country, I have to ask, when did the war on poverty turn into a war against the poor? Joining me now to talk about just that, I'm joined by Eugene Courier, organizer with the Answer Coalition, author of the book Shackled and Chained. Eugene, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, as always.
Eugene, I wanted to take a quick look at some of these headlines. U.S. poverty rises despite economic recovery. 4 out of 5 Americans face near poverty. That is insane. Why are we seeing this kind of downward trend after 50 years of fighting the so-called war on poverty?
Well, I think what we're seeing is really the results of the fact that, well, in general, capitalism is one of the types. The reality of it is, you know, there's only but so much wealth, and most of it goes to really rich people. But more immediately, we've seen that even the smaller steps taken, starting with the Johnson administration, the war on poverty, a 35-year assault on every social program, on unions, on pensions, wages that don't keep up with productivity. So essentially, even the smallest measures, just about every measure that helps mitigate poverty, has been taken away, while many, many measures that help enhance the wealth of the 1% of the few have been continually boosted forward by the government. So we've seen a greater immiseration of people.
I'm glad you mentioned benefits, because I wanted to take a look at this 2013 census supplemental poverty measure. Almost 50 million people in the U.S. are poor. Food stamps keeps 5 million people out of poverty. This is the most shocking. Without Social Security, more than half of Americans over 65 and over, rather, would be in poverty. How much specifically is the assault on social services increasing this gap?
Oh, in a major way. I mean, we see that food stamps in just every budgetary cycle for the past 2 or 3 years has been one of the number one targets of Republicans, and that Democrats have connived in order to make these bargains and these deals to, you know, keep the budget going and all of that. They've caved on their principles, and they're continually agreeing to smaller than what's originally proposed reductions, but not being able to really step forward and fight for these programs. We see that they also, President Obama coming out for, or originally now, since it's an election year, he's changed his tactics so people will vote for the Democrats, but coming out for chain CPI and Social Security, which will ultimately lower people's benefits. So both parties are colluding around an agenda, which means reduced social services. And these social services are really a lifeline for people who aren't seeing any help from their wages and from their pensions, which are depressed.
They really are a lifeline. And what's amazing is that you don't really hear the GOP or Democratic Party, for instance, ever talking about the enormous amount of aid, hundreds of millions of dollars in aid given to dozens of countries around the world when we could. I mean, it's just a non-issue. The Social Security is a non-issue. I can't stress that enough. What do you think of all the measures that are being taken, as I just outlined, criminalizing the poor? I mean, not just neglecting them, straight up criminalizing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's truly unbelievable in so many different ways, because every politician says they care about the poor. They say they care about the homeless. This is like the number one thing. But we see over and over again, whether it's food distribution, anything of that nature is being criminalized and being further put into channels that make it harder and harder for people to engage in mutual aid type solidarity. For people who, and this is sort of one of the quietest kept secrets of America, it's people who have more modest means who give the most money to charity. And so this is just a way to stop people and to more directly control how people interact with each other. And that's something we're seeing on just about every level in this society, a greater curtailment, a panopticon from the NSA and others, and all sorts of things that make it much harder for us to interact as human beings and much easier for the corporate, big business-controlled government to define what our lives are and what our values and the ideological frame of our society will be.
Yeah, well said. I mean, it just is really disturbing to have the middle class and even upper class say, we just don't want to see it. Mm-hmm. People in Silicon Valley, whatnot, not too many middle class in Silicon Valley, of course, but clearly there's something deeply wrong here. As I mentioned, corporate profits record high, income inequality growing faster than every other industrialized country, disturbing. How can we address this beyond just superficial adjustments here? Because we're not seeing anything be done. In fact, it's getting worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have to do a number of things. One, we have to really look at true living wages, $15 an hour. That's just one place to start. We live here in Washington, D.C. If you're a single mother, a living wage is $27 an hour.
Wow.
If the minimum wage had kept up to where it was in the mid-60s, it'd be something like $28 an hour. So we see how far we are behind in terms of wages. We also need to allow workers the right to organize. We need to bring back pensions and not have people have to gamble their money in the stock market to have a real retirement. And ultimately, we need to move beyond our current system, this capitalist system that really favors profit over people. And we need to move to an area where, you know, there's so much rural poverty. This is where they go with the Keystone XL pipeline and things like that. And they say, here's all this money because you live in poverty. We need a system that over and above all needs prioritizes people and the planet over and above profit and, you know, corporate billionaires buying Aspen ski lodges.
You know, I agree that capitalism in its current form is definitely failing, Eugene, but I think it's just so much for people to really accept that. Let's abandon the system, embrace a new one, completely restructure society. Is there anything that we can do within the framework that exists, as you just mentioned? I mean, pushing for pensions, unions, stuff like that. I know that you're running for city council here in D.C. Talk about kind of the small local measures that people can take here in the city outward to address this and help uplift the poor.
Definitely. I think people need to push for higher wages. That's, I mean, one of the number one issues is that our wages, they haven't kept up with productivity. They haven't kept up with the cost of living. So there's people who are going to work every single day who live in homeless shelters. And when we look at that reality, I think that's one of the biggest number one issues, is that we have to bring wages back in line with reality of what it costs to live. And that's why I'm pushing for a $15 minimum wage here in Washington, D.C. We're seeing it catching fire all across the country with fast food, low-wage worker strikes, Shama Sawan in Seattle, who I know you've also had on your show. So this is, I think, one of the first key steps that we must take, is to really find a way to make the minimum wage a living wage and to give workers on their job the ability to organize, to find ways to just close these gaps, bring back pensions, and certainly also close some of the deeper inequalities like the gender gap.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much, Eugene Pierre.
Okay,
really
so much
appreciate
for having
coming
me.
On. It's been said that a revolution without dancing is a revolution not worth having. And indeed, art and music play an integral role in this revolution of consciousness. Here on Breaking the Set, I try to feature as many grassroots artists, activists, and third-party voices marginalized by the mainstream that I can. And coming up on May 10th, there's going to be a festival in L.A. doing the same thing. It's called United We Stand. It's going to feature live performances from tons of amazing musicians like Immortal Technique, Brother Ali, panel discussions from some groundbreaking indie journalists, and speeches from people like former Congressman Dennis Kucinich. Join me now as the person making it all happen, Christina Tobin, founder and chair of the Free and Equal Elections Foundation. Amazing to have you on, Christina.
Abby, thank you so much for having me. Hi to you and your team out in D.C.
Thank you. So, Christina, this festival is going to be epic. Why did you put this event together?
The whole world is waking up, and they're looking at the United States, and we the people need to find and be part of a platform that brings everybody together to shift the power back to the people through education. So the United We Stand Festival is a kickoff for a 10-stop university bus tour we'll be having through 2015, but we're kicking it off at UCLA this May 10th. The world is in need. We need to take our government back positively, peacefully, and powerfully.
Absolutely, Christina. Well said. And what I love about this festival is that it really features people from all sides of the spectrum. And I don't even want to say radical voices, because these are the voices that people actually want and need to hear. And a lot of people, the majority of Americans, actually agree with what these people are going to say. Talk a little bit about the format. I mean, I know that there's online features of extended panel discussions. What can people expect to attend?
Oh, it's going to be like nothing before. 10,000 people at the Poly Pavilion. There's going to be artists, to poets, to comedians like Lee Camp, to you, Abby. You're going to be there. I'm really excited about that. Larry King, Marianne Williamson, spiritual. She's running for Congress in California's independent 33rd district. So really a variety of individuals. We have Ben & Jerry's of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. They're going to be their sponsor now for our fest. David Bronner, the CEO of Dr. Bronner's Magic Soap. So we're here to shift the market, not only for the electoral arena, but for the music industry, for the honest media. We're here to create an alternative platform here at Free and Equal. FreeAndEqual.org.
Absolutely. And I know that you care about this issue as much as I do, about kind of bridging this gap between left and right. And I feel like the media is doing its best to really keep us divided amongst each other and not against the people we should be, Christina. Why is it so important for Free and Equal to do just that?
Because, you know, a few powerful people use tools like the two-party system, the Commission on Presidential Debates, mainstream media, the Federal Reserve, the list goes on and on, to intentionally divide us. And so we've got to unite as a country peacefully, positively, and we're focusing on the youth. The polls say that people consider themselves to be independents over 60%. They want to replace every member of Congress. The 18 to 28-year-olds, the youth, they're the game changers, that is, for the upcoming elections. So here at Free and Equal Elections, again, we're a nonprofit 501c3 organization that's here to educate and to empower the people.
Absolutely. And once the festival's over, as amazing as it's going to be, how does Free and Equal plan on using the momentum to build fair, free elections so that we can continue the movement and really take this country back?
This is my destiny. I'm 32 years of age, and I will be doing this for the rest of my life. I love the world. I love the life. I want to bring about peace. And the United We Stand Festival is one of many initiatives. We have a Free and Equal Network that will be here to pull in and build others, working with yourself, RT. We have a store where we'll sell products of all the amazing musicians, artists, intellectuals coming together. We have an educational curriculum that's going to evolve. I feel classes throughout all universities, high schools, and so on. And finally, the election assistant, which is the heart of Free and Equal Elections. That's here to list every single candidate running for office, whether Democrat, Republican, independents. I do foresee with this shift that independents are going to rise. I think parties will fade away, money in politics. And you can learn more about us at Free and Equal, freeandequal.org.
And Christina, we have about 10 seconds left. Where can people go to find out more and get tickets? Freeandequal.org?
Yes, the tickets are $17.76. I thought that was perfect. And amazing sponsors like Ben & Jerry's, Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps are supporting this. But we need you, the people, to come and help us and support, because I am not selling out to big corporations.
Absolutely. That's why I love it. Thank you so much, Christina Tobin. See you soon.
Thank you.
That's our show, you guys. Have a great weekend. Join me again next week when I break the set all over again.
Get. But that's just my opinion.
Regularly, Max Kaiser. Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. We live in a casino gulag economy. And so, it's wise to remember what Hunter S. Thompson said. All gamblers lose regularly, but they rarely discuss it in public. Losing is bad for the image, dude. Nobody buys hot tips from losers. Remember that. Stacy.
Max, we're going to look at losers today in our headlines. Author of Oligarchy Paper says, the working class has lost. Martin Gillens, the Princeton University professor who co-authored the paper that basically argues that the U.S. is an oligarchy, said in an interview on Tuesday that he agreed with the ideas that the class war is over and that the working class has lost. Max, his exact quote here is, I mean, for now, it certainly seems like it. The middle class has not done well over the past 3.5 decades and certainly has not done well during the Great Recession. The political system responded to the crisis in a way that led to a pretty nice recovery for economic elites and corporations.
Two ships passing in the night. Remember back when the Berlin Wall fell? It was claimed to be the end of history. Some fellow named Fukuyama, I believe. We wrote a big piece about this is the end. Capitalism has won. Democracy has won. But what we have found is that it was more in terms of the collapse gap, as Dmitry Orlov speaks about. The old Soviet Union collapsed. They're moving away from oligarchy. America is collapsing now, and they're moving toward oligarchy. I think that's what people don't understand about the Russia-America dynamic, is that Russia is moving away from the oligarchical past, from the state control, command and control. America's moving toward autocracy, and the gulag, the casino gulag state is becoming America. That's what the dynamic that people miss.
And in terms of the hot tips from losers, the fact is that most Americans are losers, but survey after survey shows that they think they're not. They think they're some sort of like middle class or upper middle class or on their way to being one of these oligarchs. And I think that even though we have that oligarchic system in America, I think that the people selling the hot tips to these losers are the ones that say, okay, Soros is bad if you're a red team member or a right-wing person, and the Koch brothers are bad if you're on the other side. So they have these, you know, they fight these two elites there. And yet, as the paper that this guy wrote points out, the government sometimes acts in a ways consistent with a majority view, but only when the rich and or connected also support those policies.
Right. Americans don't want to cop to the fact that they are losers. They are some of the big globalization losers. It was just published this past week that the middle class in Canada now enjoys a greater standard of living than in America. 20 years ago, it was nowhere near the standard of living in America. Now Canada is above the U.S. in terms of standard of living. So all of the Reagan-esque warmongering and war spending of his era introduced what, again, Dmitry Orlov calls this collapse gap. The Soviet Union collapsed first, and now 25, 30 years later, America is collapsing, essentially, and the rest of the world is coming out of that collapse. So the U.S. is still kind of entering their collapse.
Well, there are losers in other parts of the world. The hot tips for losers in America, they keep on buying those hot tips over and over, even though they get defrauded with every single hot tip they buy from some guy from Wall Street. In the rest of the world, they don't buy those hot tips so easily. Meet the new losers of China, the Diaoxi, a term that literally translates as male pubic hair.
That's what they call the losers in China.
Yeah, that's the literal translation, Diaoxi, and it, in Google, translates it as a wire. So,
I mean, I've heard of being, you know, caught by the short and curlies, but I've never heard that the wire or pubic hair is synonymous with loser as such. But in China, of course, it's a different epistemological interpretation of what the significance of the little sprouts coming out from one's pelvic area might mean.
Well, figuratively, it is a declaration of powerlessness in an economy where it is getting harder for the regular guy to succeed. Calling yourself a Diaoxi has also become a proud statement of solidarity with the masses against the perceived corruption of the wealthy. So in China, they're not buying the hot tips from you know, from the winners. They know they're all losers down below because society has chosen it for them, especially with property prices climbing well beyond their reach. Now, this is the unique thing about this, you know, the post-global financial collapse world is we've only got house bubbles globally everywhere. No jobs, no incomes rising, but these house bubbles. So it's actually driving the middle class. This is the middle class in China. This guy, for example, that they talked to is making $8,000 a year, which is a lot more than most people in China make. And yet the guy's suffering because he's not second generation rich and his family isn't in the Communist Party leadership.
Okay, so there's a group of Chinese that are identifying with the downtrodden, even though they are in fact considered middle class, almost upper middle class by that amount of money that you quoted there. So this goes back to the French Revolution. I believe it were the culottes, if I'm not mistaken, who were the middle class folks who were identifying with the working class pre-revolution. So that's what it sounds like there. Or if I'm mispronouncing that name and referencing a fashion statement from forward fashion types in the 1970s feminist movement who wore culottes. I could be wrong.
Well, again, the guy that they profiled said that because he's not second generation rich or the son of a powerful government official, it's impossible for him to succeed. But, you know, compare that to the U.S., where all these losers don't even think they're losers because they don't know that, first of all, the richest area in America, all around Washington, D.C. Why? Because they're powerful government officials or connected to powerful government officials. So America has the same exact system, but all these people are running around thinking, like, we're winners. We're number one. USA, USA. This guy's not running around going, China, China. He knows he's a loser. He's a male, pile of male pubic hair.
Well, I think I read last week that America is now taking 50% of global prescription drugs, which includes antidepressants, antipsychotics, and other prescriptions of people. I mean, it's hard to be self-aware of one's situation in life as a loser when you're high on meth. And that's, you know, America is the land of the 10,000 meth labs.
Well, again, the housing bubble creating losers around the world because that was like the last vestige of a path to the middle class, if you could flip your houses, you know. So here we'll go into California and look at the losers there. Moving in with parents becomes more common for the middle-aged. For 7 years through 2012, the number of Californians aged 50 to 64 who live in their parents' homes swelled 67.6% to 194,000, according to the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research and the Insight Center for Community Economic Development.
Well, it's the American kibbutz, essentially. I mean, it's communism. It's the communal living driven by economic austerity imposed by oligarchs on Wall Street. So once again, two ships passing in the night. Russia's moving away from communism. America is embracing community collectivism, community living, communism. So again, you see this misinterpretation of the tectonic plates of history by those who are too unstable to see what's really happening.
One of the people they profiled was this woman about 55, 60 years old who's had to move back in with her mother, who's 80, who's been living on her own for the last 40 years and is really upset with this communal living, doesn't like a whole family suddenly living in her house and the kitchen being used by people that she doesn't want to be using it, the shower having different male pubic hair.
Well, yeah, I mean, the America is supposedly the home of the individual and individualism and individual achievements, but that has failed. So now we have this communal back to community living to save costs because of the austerity imposed by Wall Street kleptocrats and plutocrats, and now forcing people to live, you know, shanty towns in the middle America. It's becoming a huge shanty town like Falabas.
Fabulous.
In Brazil.
Well, and also, according to this research, the jump is almost exclusively the result of financial hardship caused by the recession rather than for other reasons, such as the need to care for aging parents.
That's what exactly. It's not, they're not trying to reach out to grandma and grandpa because they're dying and they need somebody to hold their hand at some euthanasia clinic in Des Moines. No. The problem is that they themselves have been disenfranchised, and they need mommy and daddy to take care of them, even though they're 50, 60 years old. It's like a freaking kibbutz. It's like, you know, a bunch of babushkas out there in Nowheresville all trying to you know, fortified their defenses against the kleptocrats that now rule America.
Yeah, but think of the different lifestyles of the 80-year-old versus the 50-year-old who grew up. The 80-year-old was part of that greatest generation. They had real jobs. They returned from World War II. They had real jobs creating real wealth. These other people were sold hot tips from losers. They didn't realize that they were losers selling them dreams. It was people on Wall Street, such as yourself back in the 80s, calling them up, convincing them that they can make money for free. You know, they can make money from money. They could just flip some shares to some other chump somewhere, or their house to some chump, or buy some Puerto Rican bonds. And, you know, that's what you did.
Yes, I was a Wall Street golden boy, as the French refer to them, back in the 80s, essentially partaking in the financialization and the deregulation that was ushered in by Reagan and Thatcher. And those people who were my clients, for the most part, I would say are probably now poverty-stricken because I took all their money. I'm sorry, but... A yuppie's got to eat. A yuppie does what a yuppie does. I'm sorry you're broke, but I'm doing okay.
So finally here, part of this reason why all these middle-aged people, aside from you and what you sold them, are moving in with their parents, still buying the golden American dream. So this is a chart from the Gallup poll, and they found that the number one investment, according to Americans, that they see as the best long-term returns is real estate. Number two is gold. Stocks are three, and bonds are down there at the last. So the guy writing this says, look at those figures. The top two assets are gold and real estate. This shows how out of touch with reality the average American is. According to the U.S. Census Bureau survey of construction, single-family real estate generates a 0.74% annual return over the last 30 years. That's versus gold, which returned 7.8% per year. Stock at 8.4% per year, and bonds were just 3.2%. So gold was a much better performer, but most of the middle class has all of their pension, their savings, everything in their house because they think that's the best return.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's led to the property bubble, is that there are no alternatives, really, as Mark Thatcher would say. There is no alternative but to participate in a massive property bubble in London and get, you know, your shfing-shfing reamed and lose your shirt and become called a pubic hair in China, which sounds pretty bad. I'm thinking of some Jamaican slang terms for loser, which I'm not even going to say on the show because I'm not sure people are prepared for that. But Stacey, we got to go. I'm taking my pubic hairs and I'm leaving. So we'll catch up with you later.
Okay, see you later.
Stay tuned for the second half, a whole lot more. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to Neil Mitchell, international businessman and RBS claimant. Neil, welcome back to the Kaiser Report.
Thank you for having me back.
All right, Neil Mitchell, what is the latest in your campaign against the taxpayer-owned Royal Bank of Scotland and its subsidiary, GRG, the Global Restructuring Group?
Since I last saw you, we've now launched the RBS GRG Business Action Group. We've launched it legally. We've appointed lawyers and QCs. And we've now attracted already over 400 British businesses of all sizes into what will become a group legal action against RBS Group. On top of that, I'm participating in the preparation of a number of civil and criminal legal cases. And I'm currently touring the country meeting more and more business victims, although I hate using that word, business people who've suffered at the hands of RBS, and helping them in the preparation of their individual cases. And on top of all of that, I still spend time liaising with the Serious Fraud Office, the HMRC, and the FCA. Recently, I've been liaising with the American authorities. So it's certainly advanced since we last spoke in December.
We did mention you were talking to the American authorities, meaning the SEC.
Yeah.
Because Royal Bank of Scotland has some part of their company trades on exchange in the U.S.?
Well, also, one of the misnomers of the Tomlinson report is that it was just SMEs. And in fact,
small to medium enterprises.
Yeah. And in fact, a number of the companies affected by this were actually large. large. Some of them were quoted in the London Stock Exchange.
And quoted in the New York Stock Exchange.
And they were also quoted in the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay, I'll put a pin on that for a second. Let's just talk a little bit more about, remind the audience about Global Restructuring Group, what you've been accusing them of, and specifically what they did to your company.
What they did to my company and what in fact they do as a system to every company that goes through GRG is to have the business relationship banking manager tip the company into this thing called GRG that then sets a new banking contract with them, new levels of fees and interest charges and all sorts of payments, and then also sells them additional products that basically swamps these enterprises with additional costs. As soon as the enterprise breaches any covenant or looks like it's going to be in any trouble, quite often put there by the increased fees put by the bank or by the products like interest rate swaps sold by the bank or property revaluations demanded by the bank, then the business gets put into this unit, and effectively they then put the business into administration, and then they sell the assets. And quite often they sell them to their own company, West Register, and they then hide those in various subsidiaries of West Register here and in offshore structures.
So it sounds a little bit like the mafia. So in the United States, the mafia will torch a dry cleaning shop that they might have an interest in or a restaurant to get the insurance payment. Mm-hmm. So here you have Royal Bank of Scotland, who, because of the malfeasance of its directors and previous directors, found themselves needing a huge bailout and needing lots of cash.
Yep.
So like the mafia in a similar situation, they created a subsidiary, or they work with their subsidiary, Global Restructuring Group, to target small to medium enterprises, and not so small, for demolition, for destruction, to be crushed and sold off for pieces to game the system and to act like a banking cartel, a banking mafia. The Serious Fraud Office, what's the Serious Fraud Office saying?
The last time I met with them, their inquiries were broadening and deepening, and they were now going to go and start meeting with investors and chairman and chief executives of 11 major British companies, much larger than my company, some of them household names, large brand names, that also were put through GRG, and as I understand it, that was the next phase.
Okay, Lawrence Tomlinson, that's a name that is also a part of this story.
Yep.
He wrote a report. And he's not an official government chap, but he has connections, I guess.
Yeah,
he's a plugged in guy. He's fully wired up. He wrote a report which led to the recent Clifford Chance report, which RBS claims cleared them of fraud. Speak on that for a moment.
Well, I've met Lawrence a number of times. I've been in at the Department of Business. I provided him with intelligence, case studies, and I even introduced him to a number of key advisors. And the one thing that Lawrence doesn't suffer from is a lack of evidence and a lack of case studies. The Clifford Chance.
What is Lawrence's? What is he? He's a business. He's with the Chamber of Commerce. He's a business.
I know
he doesn't like to be called Larry, because I tried to tweet him on Twitter and I said, "Hey, Larry, come on my show." And the only thing I ever heard from him was, "Listen, I don't like to be called Larry, mate." And that was the end of that conversation. But anyway, what does he do exactly?
He's a businessman who was seconded into Department of Business as what they called an entrepreneur in residence, and he was asked to look into banking behavior by Vince Cable, and he's been doing that for the last year.
Okay, Vince Cable is the business secretary.
Yes, he is.
Okay, and this obviously is bad for business if you have a predatory bank demolishing small and medium enterprises.
Let's be clear. Vince Cable has known about this for 4 years because I've made 27 representations to him in 4 years. I know other MPs, businessmen, lawyers who've made representations to him. When I met Lawrence Tomlinson in August 2013, he explicitly told me that the minister knew about this and had a copy of his report in August. In November, Vince Cable went live on good old BBC television, lied to the nation, and said that he didn't know anything about this until Tomlinson gave him his report at the end of November. I've got letters in a file in this very studio that show that Cable, from his senior policy advisor, from Lawrence Tomlinson, and from Vince Cable himself, that show that he knew about this for 4 years and covered it up.
How much is the problems here associated with this idea that these four major banks in the UK and other banks in the U.S. have, that if you come to prosecute us, we're going to crash the economy? In other words, it, not only is it mafia tactics to rape and pillage and burn down small to medium enterprises for a few bucks, but they're also using blackmail and extortion, RBS is, mm-hmm. engaging to like a Vince Cable. Is Vince Cable free to act, or is he like in America, for example, Hank Paulson was told when he was testifying before Congress in 2008 in the back rooms that if he didn't allow for that huge $750 billion dollar bailout of Goldman Sachs, that they were going to crash the economy. This is in the public record. Is Vince Cable similarly being held hostage by the banking lobbyists?
I think yes, certainly by the banking lobbyists, but also by the Treasury, because the only people that can effectively intervene in this, other than the criminal and regulatory investigative authorities, is the Treasury. And what they need to do is remove Sir Philip Hampton as chairman, because he's known about this for 4 years and covered it up. They need to allow the criminal and regulatory authorities to put bankers in court. I look forward to seeing bankers in court. I look forward to seeing them in court myself. They must address the bonus issue. We cannot be having RBS bankers being paid 200% of their salary for failure as a bonus. And my view is that the best action here is for the public to withdraw their money from RBS, from businesses to move their business accounts. The best place to hit RBS is in the pocketbook.
Okay, let me backtrack for a second. You mentioned the Treasury there. Mm. Just because I'm an American, I don't know the system as well as you do. How is the Treasury separate then from the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the number 11 Downing Street, George Osborne? How are those two interactions? Is it a separate office?
The Treasury report directly into George Osborne. This is ultimately his responsibility.
Okay, so this does come under Osborne then.
Absolutely.
And so getting back to Clifford Chance then, what did they say about the global restructuring group, the chop shop of Royal Bank of Scotland?
Well, let's just dismiss this report for a start. I mean, RBS paid Clifford Chance £1.5 million, effectively taxpayer money, to write a report that cleared them. Clifford Chance are conflicted in this because they earned £6 million in fees last year from RBS. They themselves have been advisors to GRG. In relation to the study, it's 60 pages of utter nonsense. There's a lot of inaccuracies in it. I've read every word of it. A lot of inaccuracies. And the RBS spin doctors have basically used the term that Clifford Chance have cleared them. Even Clifford Chance found a whole series of things that were wrong in customer service, in bankers' behaviour. And lo and behold, RBS have now announced that they're going to close West Register, which to me is an admission of liability, an admission of guilt.
Right, so burying the dead bodies, hiding the dead bodies.
Clifford Chance, apparently, I was told this yesterday, were involved in the cover-up of the David Kelly suicide in relation to weapons of mass destruction. Clifford Chance
are
masters. They're masters in cover-ups, and that's what this is about.
Well, I mean, Neil, we see this collusion, really, between the big law firms, the big accountancy firms like KPMG, Pricewaterhouse, Ernst & Young, the big banks, Royal Bank of Scotland, the money managers, politicians like Osborne. They collude, and they profit handsomely, and the wealth is concentrating more and more at the very top, and they're imposing austerity to pay for it, and people are suffering. So, yeah, Clifford Chance, I'm sure, is part of the racket. So many, like in the show Breaking Bad, remember Saul? Time to call Saul. So they're the Saul. Clifford Chance is the Saul. What was Saul's last name in that series, Breaking Bad? I don't recall. But they're effectively performing that role in this conspiracy.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not a theory of a conspiracy. This is an outright conspiracy. So but let me ask this.
Yeah,
let me jump in here, because here we have Neil Mitchell, Vince Cable, George Osborne, Lawrence Tomlinson, Clifford Chance. In my experience of observing British law, is essentially everyone writes reports.
Yep.
They write reports.
Yep.
Then you do an inquiry.
Yeah.
Then they write another report.
Yeah.
And it just goes away.
Well, we haven't even had a proper inquiry yet, and that's what the government need to do. They need to have a proper inquiry. Andrew Tyrie, chairman of the Treasury Select Committee, should, with oversight of the Treasury, should intervene also. This bank is morally, technically, financially bankrupt, and it's going to require a second bailout. The level of absolutely. The level of compensation in the claims that we're going to take forward will require that. The chairman of the bank himself, Sir Philip Hampton, said that at its peak, GRG was handling $91 billion of British business assets going through that department of the bank. Clifford Chance in the report have tried to play that down, that GRG was small, West Register was small. Utter nonsense. Even in the RBS annual report and accounts, it shows you the size and scale of this.
Yeah, by the way, any of these gentlemen I mentioned, including George Osborne, they're free to come on my show and offer a counter argument to anything we're talking about today. That's a standing offer I've made weeks and weeks ago. I haven't, so far that the phone hasn't rung. Hello?
Yeah.
Is that you, George? Yeah, no, yeah, come on down.
But, I would love to debate this with them, too. You can have me back.
Well, they're cowards. See, bullies are by definition cowards. So here at RBS, the play yard bully, they find what they think are the weak kids in the schoolyard, and they shake them down. It's a shakedown, right?
They won't even meet with me, Max.
Scandalous. Well, I mean, they're bankers, so there's so many bankers and so few nooses. Neil Mitchell, we're out of time. Thanks once again for being on the Kaiser Report.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Neil Mitchell. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.
Okay, just a second, everybody. This is that.
Is that there is a terrifying degree of stagnation in the broad middle of the economy. People's real wages aren't improving, their prospects aren't improving, and that discontent is the driving force through a lot of our politics, left and right.
What's surprising as well, the poor in much of Europe appear to earn more than in the U.S. I mean, how can that be reversed?
The answer there is that in Europe, all of this is after tax, let's keep in mind, right?
Okay.
So Europe taxes people a lot more and gives a lot more money to their poor people. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's it. It's a policy choice. Taxation rates are very high. If you do a list of OECD countries of percentage of GDP that goes to taxes, we're 20th, something like that, right? So there's Denmark and all the Scandinavian countries mm-hmm. up here, and you work your way down to us. So it's a policy choice. I mean, those countries have made a policy choice that they don't want the poor people. They don't want... They think there's a standard above which everyone in their society should live. That's just a brute fact about what it means to be a Dane, what it means to be a Spaniard.
What about the divide? I mean, that report last week that said the average CEO makes $11.1 million and the average American worker makes, less than $35,300?
You're seeing this accelerating inequality, and you've seen it for a long time. One of the things that was in the Times piece about the American middle class was that even that it is no longer the case that the American middle class is the richest middle class in the mm-hmm. world. The richest rich people in the U.S. are the richest rich people in the world, right?
Right.
Like, the top is still doing the best of anywhere in the world. And, you know, again, that's the other side of this sort of underlying set of economic circumstances that I think drive a lot of politics in this country.
Yeah. The Affordable Care Act, let's move to that because the president announced last week 8 million people had signed up. Is this now the law of the land and no one's going to be able to overturn it?
Yes. Yep.
So what are the Republicans doing, and do you think they're going to have more votes?
I think they are genuinely at a loss at this point. I think you're starting to see it all turn around because repeal is not popular. It's not even popular according to the New York Times Kaiser polling that came out yesterday. It's not even popular in the American South where the law is not popular. I mean, Georgia, Louisiana, North Carolina, Arkansas, the law is not popular. It's not super unpopular. It's just not super popular. And repeal is even less popular. People do not want the law repealed. And when that number goes from 8 million to 9 million, and from 9 to 10, and from 10 to 15, and from 15 to 20, and from 20 to 30, you take it away from 30 million people.
So a third rail, if you will, like Social Security.
Yeah.
How long you think till it gets there?
A generation.
Generation. So there'll be fights until then?
There's always going to be fights. I mean, in some ways, we still fight about Medicare, right? We still fight about Social Security. So there'll always be fights. But you will not see people talking about... No one who want, you know, no one comes out and says, let's repeal Social Security, let's repeal Medicare, right?
Yeah.
So the idea of repealing is just going to be preposterous. And that might happen in much sooner than 20 years. That might happen in 5 or 10.
Got to talk about kids.
So I've got a almost 2.5-year-old named Ryan, my daughter, and my son, who's 4 weeks today, named David. And my wife's incredible. The kids are incredible. It's great. I love it.
You're probably having a lot of daddy daughter bonding time, right? Because that's who you are on.
The best thing about paternity leave was my daughter and I spent so much time together, and it was so intense, and she was so affectionate, and it was really important for me to be there from a kind of attention standpoint, mm-hmm. which is that she was this kind of volcano of emotion.
She has you right here, doesn't she? Just kind of wrapped.
I do love her. I do love her very much.
Yep. Of course, you can see All In with Chris Hayes every weeknight at 8 p.m. right here on MSNBC. And tomorrow... persists in some classrooms today. It's called Segregation Now, and the talks about resurgence of separate and unequal education in the United States. ProPublica civil rights reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones wrote that piece. Nicole's in studio and joins me now. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about your report, which focuses on schools in Alabama. So explain what's happening there and why you chose to focus on the South.
Well, I focused on the South because, contrary to popular belief, the South went from the most segregated region of the country to the most integrated region of the country. And it's been that way for 40 years, largely because of court orders that forced the South to desegregate. But over the last 20 years, those court orders have been being lifted. And as they've been lifted, many Southern districts are starting to resegregate.
Is this a problem exclusive to the South?
Oh, absolutely not. The difference between the South and the Northeast and the Midwest is that the Northeast and the Midwest have never really undergone major desegregation. So the most segregated parts of the country for Black students are, in fact, outside of the South. But because the South did so much work in this area and also educates the most Black students, we have the most to lose there.
So, okay, why is this happening? Give me the background and who's being most adversely affected by it, if you can be specific.
Okay, well, what's happening is when districts were under court order, any move that they would make that could possibly lead to resegregation, they had to go before a judge. Mm-hmm. And this gave the plaintiffs a chance to say, don't build this school in this area or don't rezone in this way because it's going to further segregate students. But once those court orders are dismissed, districts can do almost anything that they want as long as no one can prove that they did so with the intent to discriminate. So what happened, for instance, in Tuscaloosa, Tuscaloosa had been forced by a judge to combine its two largely segregated high schools into one single citywide integrated high school. And as soon as it was released from the court order, it split that high school into three schools, including one that was entirely Black. And that high school, 14 years later, remains entirely Black.
Okay, so if court-ordered desegregation mandates have proven to be effective in the past, why are they being lifted by federal judges?
I think there are a lot of reasons. Beginning in the early 1990s, the Supreme Court made it clear that these orders were not to be permanent. It made it much easier for school districts to be released. They no longer had to show that they had eliminated all the vestiges of segregation, but only that they had tried to do so and had made a good faith effort. So, and I also think that there's a great deal of fatigue. Many people, including judges, believe that these orders have lasted long enough.
You know, according to a recent study by the UCLA Civil Rights Project, schools in New York State are the most segregated. What's your reaction to that?
Well, it's true. And the reason that that is true is because there's a great deal of residential segregation in the Northeast. New York City is one of the most highly segregated cities in the country. And so you see that reflected in the schools. And also, frankly, in the Northeast and the Midwest, there's been very little political support behind efforts that would help to integrate these schools.
In your reporting, are there ideas on how to reverse this trend?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's ways that you can do it. Magnet programs, you can open up, instead of drawing attendance zones around kind of very compact, segregated schools, you can draw attendance zones that draw from both white areas and black areas. There's a lot of different ways that it can be done, but I think the difficulty is mustering the political will to do so.
How about the public will as well? I mean, the folks in Alabama that you interviewed, Nicole, how do they feel about this? How aware are they about this, and how much do they want change?
Well, I would say political will is driven by public will. If the public were crying out for integration in the schools, then that would happen. But that's not, at least the people who are most powerful in communities are not asking for it. So in Alabama, there's a great deal of denial. There's a great deal of denial that even though one third of black students in Tuscaloosa can attend school their entire 13 years without ever having a white classmate, they will tell you that they have upheld their duty to integrate. So you have, I guess, communities that are denying the harms that are being caused.
So 60 years ago to now, how far have we come?
Well, we certainly come a great deal from 1954. What George Wallace and what other segregationists wanted was that white children would not attend schools with black children. Those days are largely gone. There are very few all-white schools left in this country, but there are a lot of all-black schools. And so kind of what you could say is that the segregationists didn't win, but the integrationists haven't won either.
So finally, Nicole, your takeaway from all this and everything that you've learned is what?
Well, the takeaway is that our educational system is still separate but unequal. And I think we have, at this point, gone back to believing that we can make these segregated schools equal, and we have yet to do so.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, great piece. Thank you so much for talking with me about it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Okay, everybody. There has definitely been a step up in the energies, and that means the activities of active-minded people has also moved. And may we all pass every test, and may our movements be wise. As you might say, we are becoming the elders of our time, or we are, oh my, and our sister Dahani Yahu is definitely setting the example. So let's work with this a little bit tonight. Okay, the peacemaker, the luminous one, came again in 1650. Many say he was born again around 1983, and as prophesied, would remain hidden until the right time. Amazing. Let me make sure that's okay. He comes during the hell periods in the Mayan calendar, which is similar to the Cherokee calendar. In the northern United States and Canada, many have picked up an old hitchhiker. Once in the car, this person becomes young, changes sex, and even changes race before your eyes, and then proof disappears. The seven reminders. The seven reminders are points of reference for how the individual appears and relates to the dance of many beings. The seven reminders are key to understanding relationships energized by the pulse of the sacred hoop. 1. What walks, swims, flies, walks, or crawls are in relationship with one another, and the mountains, streams, and valleys are also in a dynamic relationship with each person. Two, what occurs around and within reflects one's own mind and shows the dream one is weaving. Three principles of awakened mind guide enlightened action. The will to see the mystery as it is, first principle. Second, the intention to manifest one's purpose for the benefit of all. And third, the courage to do what must be done. Generosity of heart and action. Bring peace and abundance for all in the circle. Respect for elders, clan, land, and nation inspires acts in harmony with the sacred law and good caretaking of the gifts received. Action to benefit the land and the people onto seven generations shapes the consciousness of the planetary caretaker, dreaming those yet unborn, ever mindful of life's unfolding. To be in good relation, transforming patterns of separation and purifying conflicting emotions is to experience the wisdom within, the still lake of mystery. The nine precepts arising from these teachings are the nine precepts of the Code of Right Relationship. The nine precepts, and they are the way to keep one's vision and heart clear. 1. Speak only words of truth. 2. Speak only of the good qualities of others. 3. Be a confidant and carry no tales. 4. Turn aside the veil of anger to release the beauty inherent in all. 5. Waste not the bounty and want not. 6. Honor the light in all. Compare nothing. See all for its suchness. 7. Respect all life. Cut away ignorance from one's own heart. 8. Neither kill nor harbor thoughts of an angry nature. 9. Do now what needs doing. Enhancement activity. Use the seven reminders as a daily mediation. Pick one for each day of the week and carry it throughout the day. As one has time, keep a journal of the thoughts, experiences, and reflections that arise during the day. Over time, these reminders become a firm foundation for spiritual practitioners during doing mind training. The nine precepts are the means to expand one's mind and vision as a code of living. These precepts are keys to how we view the world and how we speak to one another. Our actions give rise to specific results. They are also related to the directions. At the end of the day, do a review before going to sleep and ask, Did I maintain the integrity of the nine precepts today? Did I joyously receive the opportunities of this day? Is it our spiritual duty to be it is our spiritual, this is a good one. It is indeed our spiritual duty to be happy. Was I happy today? It's a big deal, everybody. Note. Okay. There's a little note here for more information on the luminous one, and it suggests to see a book called He Walked the Americas by L. Taylor Hansen. And the next is Voices of Our Ancestors, Cherokee Teachings from the Wisdom Fire by Dahani Yahoo. We read that book, folks. The next one is White Roots of Peace by Paul A. W. Wallace. And this last one is Hiawatha by Walt Whitman. Wow. Okay, Brother Don, can you get a hold of our sister Rain Bird? We will be just delighted for us to have our sister Rain Bird. And while you're, Commander Don, are you there? Yes. All right. Thank you. So I'll read this chapter two, starting it anyway. Finding one's way, sensing energy paths. As we were young, sometimes my sister Pamela and I would be taken far into the woods, left alone, and told to find our way home. This was a lesson for us to learn to trust and rely on our own senses. Sometimes, as my sister and I were left in the woods together, she would make jokes about Hansel and Gretel, wondering who was the wicked stepmother. Other times, we were taken to places separately. Oh, my, my. The first aspect of this lesson in the woods was to sense the direction where we were in relation to our home. In sensing the direction, we could feel it pulling us like a thread homeward. This specific lesson would continue for days, each time with us going a little further away as we were left off in another sector of the compass. All we had to rely on were our short little legs, a keen sense of smell, and some magnetic attraction to home. I just want to mention something. I had this experience myself. Rama and I were caretaking a dog, a little dog, while our friend went to, she went to Estonia to teach to one of those little countries that's bordering Ukraine. And so, and we were living on this land in Apache Canyon. This is a trip, 212 acres in Apache Canyon. And there literally is a path from this place that would take you, and the native people around here would walk this path, and it would take you to this other place, the Sunrise Springs. That's a 69-acre piece of land, of Native American land. Yet, if you were to even drive from where Apache Canyon is to that place, it would take you about an hour. So I would go for walks with Free Dog, and I would leave early in the morning. And the first time we did, just what the story here is saying, I mean, she would take us over rivers and vales and up the mountain and start following this trail. And there was just a trail from her nose. And I would have to have faith in her taking me back where we came from, because I'm going to just tell you that it got pretty darn remote. There wasn't anybody else out there. And, you know, we just did this every day for, I mean, we were doing this for a month and a half. And so, I mean, I didn't make it all the way to Sunrise Springs, but some days I would leave in the early morning and I wouldn't get back until about 3 or 4 in the afternoon with her. That was quite a journey. That was quite a journey. I had faith in my four-legged friend. And, you know, there are bobcats up there, and there are, didn't see one, but I'm just saying sometimes I sense them. And so did she. And we saw lots of eagles and fox and even Roadrunner, as just much to be, and Crow Medicine was with us many, many of those walks. So anyway, we viewed the forest as an extension of our home, and we could feel the threads that connected us. They felt like warm currents under my feet. As I were actually walking on ocean waves with the undulating motion. As I got close to plants that could help in healing, I felt a gentle caress in my hand and a soft breeze on my cheek. Once I was left alone, not too far from my grandparents' home, and I was to listen to the sounds of certain plants. The jack in the pulpit is a rare and strange plant that grows 3 feet tall. It has a sound, and it is shaped like a cup or an iron, and insects are drawn into it and then digested. It is a very intelligent plant. On this occasion, the jack in the pulpit called me to come and observe it. A young doe appeared and looked at me with her silky black eyes that seemed as vast as space. I could not tell as the deer was a real one or the luminous one. The intelligence in the deer's eyes was as vast as the intelligence in the eyes of the luminous one or any grandparent. I listened to the wind and the sound of the forest. The deer and I stared at each other across the plant. It seems as though time had no significance. The deer had a memory of every deer in the forest, all the way back to the first deer. It was incredible. Through the meeting of our eyes, the deer revealed memories and possible futures. Deer have a group mind. They make decisions to benefit the whole. The brave ones, when needed, offer their lives to benefit and protect the herd. Some decide to come out and meet hunters so the herd can safely get away. For this reason, the Cherokee wasted no part of the deer because we knew it was an offering that others could live and eat. Even the fish that came out of the stream, one gave thanks to them because they offered themselves to be caught so our people could be fed. It was indeed our responsibility to return the bones to the river so more of them would grow. On that note, I think we'll stop there, and I pass this long-stemmed lavender Excalibur rainbow rose, emerald serpent feathered Quetzalcoatl rose, talking stick to my sister Rain Bird.
Okay, I'll take that stick.
Yes, nice and loud and clear. Thank you, Rain Bird.
Oh, good. Yeah, so thank you for another incredible day. On the phone. And in the air. So lots of gratitude for you, Tara, and you, Rama, and Hanayahu, and all these other masters we've heard from tonight. Very, very amazing. Very good program. So grateful for all of our lives and for all the ways that we show up in our lives. Grateful to be here at this time of this changing of the guard, so to speak, and such that it is. Let it be complete and infinite. So 13 thank yous and honey in the heart. And I'm looking forward to hearing some Rumi or good music from Rama. So I pass this talking stick back to you. Thank you again for all that you, your service, your divine service to the world. It's much appreciated. Aho.
Aho, sister. Okay. Now this one, just a minute, says the music maestro. Oh my, there is so many things to learn. Yes, Rami, ready? Okay, this is a Kabir poem and a love song video. Is this a new one? Okay, there's many where this came from. Here we go, everybody.
O servant,
where
is thou? I am beside thee. I am neither in temple nor in mosque. I am neither in Kaaba nor in Kailash. Neither am I in rites and ceremonies, nor in yoga and renunciation. If thou art a true seeker, thou shalt at once see me. Thou shalt meet me in a moment of time. And Kabir says, O Sadhu, God is the breath of all breath. Do not go to the garden of flowers, O friend, go not there. In your body is the garden of flowers. Take your seat in the thousand petals of the lotus and their gaze in the infinite beauty. Tell me, brother, how can I renounce Maya? When I gave up the tying of ribbons, still I tied my garments about me. When I gave up tying my garments, still I covered my body in its folds. So when I give up passion, I see that anger remains. When I renounce anger, greed is with me still. And when greed is vanquished, pride and vainglory remain. When the mind is detached and casts Maya away, still it clings to the letter. And Kabir says, listen to me, dear Sadhu. The true path is rarely found. Oh, how may I ever express that secret word? How can I say he is not like this and he is like that? If I say that he is within me, the universe is ashamed. If I say that he is without me, it is falsehood. He makes the inner and the outer worlds to be indivisibly one. The conscious and the unconscious, both are his footstools. He's neither manifest nor hidden. He's neither revealed nor unrevealed. There are no words to tell that which he is. The river and its waves are one, sir. Where is the difference between the river and its waves? When the wave rises, it is the water. And when it falls, it is the same water again. Tell me, sir, where is the distinction? Because it has been named as wave, shall it no longer be considered as water? To what shore would you cross, O my heart? There is no traveler before you, there is no road. Where is the movement? Where is the rest on that shore? There is no water, no boat, no boatman is there. There is not so much as a rope to tow the boat, nor a man to draw it. No earth, no sky, no time, no thing is there, no shore, no ford. There is neither body nor mind. And where is the place that shall still the thirst of the soul? You shall find naught in that emptiness. Be strong and enter into your own body, for there your foothold is firm. Consider it well, O my heart, go not elsewhere. And Kabir says, put all imaginations away and stand fast in that which you are. The shadows of evening fall thick and deep, and the darkness of love envelops the body and the mind. Open the window to the west and be lost in the sky of love. Drink the sweet honey that steeps the petals of the lotus of the heart. Receive the waves in your body. What splendor is in the region of the sea? Hark, the sounds of conches and bells are rising. And Kabir says, O brother, behold, the Lord is in this vessel of my body. The moon shines in my body, but my blind eyes cannot see it. The moon is within me, and so is the sun. The unstruck drum of eternity is sounded within me, but my deaf ears cannot hear it.
Play one more. Let's do this one more. This one more thing here. I just got to cue it up a little bit better. Okay. Rama, take this over there, please. Okay, this is our tenors. We got another piece for you. That was beautiful, Rama. Just gorgeous. Okay, here we go.
We would like to introduce you to a new and exciting group
four passionate classical soloists who come together from all corners of the world. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Opus X.
That gave us a whole nother look on life. I hope it did for everybody. It is so magnificent where we are headed. And May our spirit be perseverant, and may we be an inspiration to all who we come in touch with. And we look forward to the possibility of seeing you with Cheryl on tomorrow night and Monday night. Same number as we use here, 213-342-3000, and the PIN code for those two calls at 9:15 in the Eastern Zone and 6:15 in the Pacific Zone. And the PIN code is 946-7441 pound. And until that moment in time when we see you again, inshallah, I am another yourself. Peace and love, everyone. Sat Nam.
Sat Nam Ji.
Ahomi Takuyasin. Namaste.